Blog Talk Radio.
It's Friday, June 21st, 2013. This is the last word of Michael Lawson and Thomas Fortenberry. We had to, I don't know how that came across, because it was kind of, when I recorded it, was a little bit loud. Alabama played that song kind of loud. Maybe I should have just went in. Next time I'm going to go in and play the theme song right off the TV. Maybe that might be a little plainer.
But
that was from the Adam. Anyway, that was from the soundtrack.
It was still just a little nod of the head.
Tony Soprano. We are going to have Mr. George Gaffney, our extraordinaire resident movie reviewer and critic, film critic. He'll be on with us just a little bit. But, hey, you could not start the day without talking about, especially this is the last word, about Tony Soprano and what the Sopranos. See, we keep saying Tony Soprano. We don't even say
James
Gandolfini. We don't see it and say that. We say Tony Soprano. So,
you know, that's because this is a guy that's such a good actor.
Well,
he embodied that role. Now, no one could, you know, it's one of those things like, you know, there's some movies you can't remake and there's some roles that you can't.
Oh, well, no, you
nobody
can.
Nobody could be Tony Soprano.
Nobody could be Tony Soprano. I mean, you know, he was in charge and. But we're going to get some more into that. But we have so much to talk about today. We're talking about...
Speaking of Sopranos.
You know what? I feel so much better. I mean, we don't even have the time to go into what I've gone in through. What I've gone in through? What I've gone through in the last... I don't know when, but it's been a hell of a long time. And... yeah, pulse rate running 125, just jumping out of my chest.
Yeah.
And but hey, I got some medication, and they seem to feel that it's from these steroids. So you know, no wonder these guys come to in baseball season. The head is two size larger, and the feet are two size bigger because that grows.
Yeah.
But steroids
also explains why they're always, you know, fighting each other.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the George's favorite friend, the one who plays with the Giants, Bobby Bonds. I mean, not Bobby Bonds. Bobby Bonds was the father. But Mr. Bonds used steroids, and his head got two sizes bigger, and his feet got two sizes larger. And
but oddly enough, he didn't become two times smarter.
No, he didn't. He had warning track power before the steroids. And he had over the fence power after steroids, but still could not hit the curveball. So it gives you more strength,
equation.
But it don't make you a better hitter. All right. So we got the weekly regressive party wacky news.
Oh my Lord.
We got so much of it. We could spend the whole 3 hours on wacky news.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, every time we get together, Mike, we've got pages upon pages upon pages of quotes. We've got, you know, hundreds of pages of research and articles. They do so much per week, we can't even keep up. I mean, you could pick one of them. You know, when Palin was speaking, you know, her quotes alone would fill half.
No, she doesn't speak. No,
but all of these guys are so it's so rich. I mean, it's an endless mine. I don't mind having endless amount of material, but give
endless
us a
mine. Was that a movie? No, no, it's
a break, guys. We can't keep up.
So, give me some endless mine, wacky regressive party weekly news.
Oh well, what do you want to hear about?
You go. You do it.
Let's see here. I've got the gigantic stack.
I have a little more apple pie.
Oh, yeah. Hey, man. Nothing starts out a radio show better than drinking.
Absolutely.
Mikey's apple pie.
Absolutely. Got to get some more. It's all going now.
Okay. Well, this I'm going to put into our local pile.
Okay.
We got local.
Got local.
Stuff going on. And then we got here. We'll talk about this. So we'll start big. And
we'll start big, go small.
Yeah. So, how about this? Do you want to get into the, you know, masturbating fetuses? Do we want to start with Michael Burgess, retard at large?
Michael Burgess, retard.
What
Michael Burgess, retard.
Now,
let me see.
Guys are so obsessed, you know, for the years and years, well, my entire adult life. When I was going, the Republicans are the ones that are always obsessing over sex. They want to, you know, be in your bedroom. They want to have, you know, say over any kind of adult fun, no matter what it is. You know, you remember Bush famously? He's the genius who, while making it legal to carry guns into churches, outlawed the buying, possessing, or use of any sex toys in his state. You know, this kind of guy. So these are people who would rather, you know, play with their pistol.
Is that even a toothbrush?
Let you play with your pistol, you know what I'm saying? So why are they always obsessed with sex? And now we've got this genius. Now,
well, I have something that will help move this along here. Just listen for a minute.
We should be setting this at 15 weeks, 16 weeks. You watch a sonogram at a 15-week baby, and they have movements that are purposeful. They stroke their face. If they're a male baby, they may have their hand between their legs. I mean, they feel pleasure. Why is it so hard to think that they could feel pain?
So, just as a backstory,
yes,
we've been having a festival of
festival
since the Regressives had that, you know, extraordinary midterm success.
Yes.
And they took over a lot of local governments and everything. So, unfortunately for the country, the last year, 2 years, has been a bonanza of regressive
laws. With Lauren Green.
You know, they've been turning back the tides on
right.
Women's rights all over the state.
Right.
They've been limiting abortion access,
right.
You know, closing clinics.
Yeah.
Doing all kind of shenanigans because they can't do it legally, so they do all these things where they, you know, change the tax code or they make some kind of requirement that the doctor has to have 15 degrees and work in a OR during the day and only there at night or something, you know, all these weird tricks
right.
that they do to close it. So in that context, these guys always attacking anything to do with reproductive rights or education. Well, this guy, Representative Michael Burgess out of Texas, came up with this brilliant quote.
Brilliant, brilliant. It was very brilliant.
The justification for not allowing abortions is that babies masturbate in the womb. And you
no, wait, watch babies. Are we talking about just males?
Well,
are we talking about females?
He mentioned males. That's his particular specialty.
Oh, that's
male
babies.
Oh,
okay.
That's apparently,
yeah.
That's what he likes to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
Which brought up my point. Isn't it a crime to watch young children do sexual acts? And this guy is like talking about how he likes to watch on the, you know, go into the OBGYN and get that video monitor going and watch the baby masturbate. And
he said they stroke their face, and male babies, they have their hands between their legs because they feel pleasure.
Okay, pedophile boy. This is it.
And then he said, why is it so hard? That's the
term of phrase,
yeah?
I mean, that's the first thing that came to his mind. That's what I'm just saying.
And this guy is a former OBGYN.
Right, which makes you wonder, you know, what, you know, Creepazoid, what was he doing? Maybe he's got a whole collection of these movies. At the time. I don't know.
And the doctors of the AMA have said, of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists said, we don't know enough about the biology of this science. He said that we certainly can see a movement of the fetus during this time, but in terms of any knowledge about pleasure or pain, there is no data to say this.
Right. You don't know. I mean, the babies are scrunched up in the uterus. They kick, they squirm, they move around. They do that during the pregnancy. And then this guy is interpreting it as they're, you know, masturbating themselves and enjoying it. And he even points out, look, he says that there was an anecdote later. Two doctors had recently observed a female fetus at 32 weeks touching its vulva with the fingers of the right hand. I mean, this guy's like, and this is like disturbing. Okay? This is not.
Why is he trying to point that out? Because, he's trying to say that, because they feel pleasure, mm-hmm. And did he ask them?
Well, that's what I think. We have not, that's what the scientists are saying. There's no way you don't even know what you're talking about. The hand movements could even be random. But he's interpreting it as a sexual act in a fetus. That's what's unbelievable. So, again.
Well, that's why they want cameras in your house to see if you're having sexual acts.
It literally, these Republicans are the ones that want to put cameras in the women who are pregnant, you know, to make them have the ultrasound,
right.
The invasive ultrasound.
Well, then maybe if they see the boys touching themselves,
yes.
Masturbating, they say, I'm sorry, we just saw him masturbate. And when he comes out, because that's a crime, we're going to lock him up. When he comes out of the fetus, and you're going to have this child.
I just don't get their obsession with sex.
They don't want us to listen to them on a phone call. They don't want us to watch us with cameras. They don't want us to interfere with how we grow our crops. They don't want us to. You know, did you hear about the? And we don't have time for this. But there's this nut job in Maine who became governor. Well, those people in Maine are now regretting and should do everything in their power to impeach him. He is now told that the largest newspaper in the state of North Carolina and its two affiliates, they are banned for covering anything in the governor's mansion.
Right.
Since he, when he was running for office,
he's Duke dictator. That's why.
That's right. We'll get to that. When he was running for office, the person, there was another woman who was running along with him who worked for one of the energy companies. She lost the race. So what did he do? He hired her and put her in charge of all environmental conditions in North Carolina. The first thing she did was say it was okay for the power company to drain off the most pristine lake in the state of Maine and use it for their power. The federal government said that their director says you can only drain it so far in the summer and so far in the winter. They drained it down so that you could see the bottom. It looks like one of those fictional science fiction films now with the dead fish and the pollution around the lake because they have drained it completely out. This woman was their attorney for the power company. She not only now has she put every single before they got there they put every single company that was the pollutants, they were banned on doing certain things. She has now lifted all that, thrown it in the garbage. There's Nestle, there's Alcoa, there's a bunch of them that can now do whatever they want in the state.
Yeah.
And because the newspaper brought it up, they're now banned. But of course, they had the head of the newspaper, the editor, and he said, "That's all right. We will just get the story a couple of days late because under freedom of information, he can't ban that. We'll get the information."
Right. Well, look, this is again the way they operate is. They want total secrecy. They want to just do anything they want, do that, friends and family network with their people. But why is anyone surprised? This has been their way of operating forever.
Of course.
You remember both Bush administrations were infamous for banning
impotent?
Infamous.
No, that too.
Infamous
okay.
For banning, reporters' access and the people's access.
Right.
So, the last Bush, as a matter of fact, even changed the entire law through his executive order so that they didn't have to turn over any of their documents to the public, which used to be standard procedure. I mean, we are in an open democracy and it's supposed to have transparency. And instead, now, they made it where an entire administration's body of work doesn't have to be turned over, that can't be looked at, and it can go all the way. You remember they were trying to do this past their death to their family,
yes,
and their administrators of their administration,
right.
And they can decide if anything should ever be released or not. I mean, this is ridiculous, but this is the way they operate.
And, well,
it's insanity, but
well,
what do you expect?
Jan Brewer.
Oh, our favorite.
You know Jan Brewer, the finger wagger, who everybody thought was saying, yes, I waved her finger. She was pointing at Obama. She was waving her finger, and she was saying, yes, I want everything that you can give me down here in Arizona because they have poor people down there, and I need the support. So if I'm waving my finger in your face, I'm fooling those ignorant fools out there that thinks I'm yelling at you.
Mm-hmm.
She's not one of the biggest fans of Obamacare.
Yeah.
She said, I want it.
Yeah, because she
give me,
money it's saving her government.
Oh, yeah, about about $19 billion a year. As a matter of fact, Jan Brewer, embracing the key part of Democratic President Barack Obama's health care plan and in a hard-won policy victory over conservatives in her own party, Brewer, a feisty opponent of Obama administration over immigration enforcement, signed a bill that would make about 300,000 additional poor and disabled residents eligible for a Medicaid program and move opposed by a conservative Republican lawmaker.
Let's see. A Republican governor just signed a bill.
Not just a Republican governor.
Expanding Medicaid, is that what we're doing?
And this is against all the Republican lawmakers in the state.
Is she a communist?
Oh, well, hey, they think she is now. Because Brewer outmaneuvered opponents by forming a bipartisan coalition of legislators said that $1.6 billion expansion drawing on federal funds under the Affordable Care Act was the right move for the state.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is the right move for the state because guess what? She just saved them a lot of money, injected an entire segment of the population right into their economy. It's like plugging in a whole segment now. So they've got new.
Because it's also going to save them money on their budget.
Oh, it's saving the budget, but it's also putting people to work. It's giving people health care now. I mean,
work?
Get back on the
what?
Road.
What are you talking about, work?
Oh, you mean create jobs?
What? Create jobs? Holy cow. And here's what she did to the legislature. So they didn't want to do this, so she called them into special session last week armed with the votes of key minor Republican lawmakers. Both houses, which are controlled by Republicans, passed a measure with a comfortable margin. Brewer said the move would protect rural and other hospitals from raising costs of paying uninsured patients by injecting $2 billion into the state's economy and create thousands of jobs.
And let me explain to the, you know,
the uninformed.
The uninformed, we'll say that. The uninformed.
The uninformed, 646-716-5242, if you're uninformed.
Call in. Let us know. But look, this is why things like this are zero risk. This is why I can't ever understand these Republican governors all over the state going, I don't want it in my state. We ain't going to have no health care. Woo-hoo! You know,
don't want it changes.
Because not only is she helping her citizens, not only is she increasing the health of her citizens, not only is she creating jobs for her citizens, that creates a new tax base. You know, all of these things that they talk about, you know, ooh, wow, you're growing an economy. You're growing everything. Not only that, listen to this. Under the Affordable Health Care Act, the federal government pays 100% of the cost.
For the first 3 years.
100%.
For the first 3 years.
3 years, and then it only drops to 90%.
Right.
So you're talking about it's free.
But you have to pay people.
You know, I mean.
And you're getting that money.
Win-win for this lady. And that's why don't these Republicans get it? Why
well,
is this?
Because they have to. That would give Obama a credit.
Exactly.
And she also says, part of the plan, Brewer said there would be a circuit breaker to call in automatically halt to the expansion of the federal reimbursement if it decreases.
Right. So she's got built-in breaks and everything else. She's protected on every front.
What I can't understand is the Supreme Court already said it's the law of the land.
Well, it is the law. It doesn't even matter. I mean, look, it was the law already.
So these other states are breaking the law.
And then it's already been upheld in court, so it's been the law, but it's been implemented now. But all these other ones are what they're doing basically is
breaking the law. They're breaking the law.
Well, they're just like saying they're opting out or something.
Wait a minute, how can you opt out of a federal law?
I don't know. Makes you
they're breaking the law.
Yeah, it'd be like saying, you know, that civil rights thing.
Well, the thing is if they don't do it by was it October or something? Every person that gets in there that is going to have to pay, or doesn't get it, is going to pay a penalty.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to penalize all the citizens.
So they think by penalizing the citizens, it's going to make the citizens upset with Obama.
Yeah, because they can then turn around and say, see how much he costs.
Yeah.
See? They're playing this game.
Well, what happens if the citizens stop blaming them?
Here's the thing. Well, if the citizens would just be educated and wake up, then yeah, they will.
Well, not
but
most states.
The problem with all of those types of states, they're dragging their own economy into the pit. They have no health care. And then these people, when they finally are forced to get health care, they're going to be penalized and have to pay huge premiums and everything. And then, guess what? When you don't have money to spend, you don't spend it. When you're in economic chaos, your whole state is.
Well, if you're a millionaire,
yeah, but
you
that's
can spend money if you want.
But the common people in these states, which I'm sorry.
Common?
I hate to,
common?
Yeah, I hate to break the news
common?
To Republicans, but you could try all day long
yeah.
with millionaires
yeah.
to run an economy and others.
Yeah.
But, you know, about 75% of the entire economy is based on the back of those poor people. They move everything.
75? Probably 85 or 90%.
Consumer-based economy.
Because they're the ones that work.
And they're the ones that do everything. They work, they buy, they drive, you know, they got to get gas, they stop at the store and get the little Coca-Cola and the pack of chewing gum and the, you know, whatever. That is what moves the economy all day long, every day. You know, not the fact that every once in a while the millionaire goes and gets a yacht or something. But what moves the
yeah.
economy is the everyday.
And they don't buy it from that state because they don't make
yeah.
it in that state.
And if you're making your own people poor and you're making your own people unhealthy, guess what? Your entire state.
Well, I wanted to, well because Dr. Grace will be calling in, but we can mention this before she goes in. Louisiana. One of the poorest states in the union,
mm-hmm.
or are they in the union? Just telling you. Okay, yeah. Louisiana is the, I think it's the third or the, I'm trying to think if they're the third or the worst state in the union without health care. One out of every five do not have health care.
Right.
But that's not a problem because, I mean, you know, we got 50 million people without health care. But that's 20% of their population.
Exactly.
Now the thing is, it's not that, yeah, well, I don't have health care. All right, tomorrow I'll go to the insurance company. They can't get insurance in Louisiana.
Right.
Those one out of every five cannot get insurance. And I get it.
I mean,
the fact that they we don't have it, and that's it. They can't get it. There's no access to it.
And this is you're just setting your entire population and hence your entire economy of your entire state. You're setting it up to fail. You know, here's a recurrent clue for the governor down there. What was his name? Bannister.
No.
I'm walking down the banister
right.
with something I found in the window.
Yeah, something I found in the window.
Okay. Jindal is an idiot because he's hurting his population. And this is, again, a group of people who are in Hurricane Alley. You know, there's not like it's a
they get money when the hurricane knocks down their buildings, the federal government comes in and pays for it. That's the only money they see.
But this is what I'm saying, though. You've got a population at high risk of damage, of storms, of, you know, the sickness and illness that comes in on that because you disrupt, you know, electricity, you contaminate water supplies, you do all of these type of things when these major disasters occur. And then you've got no one with insurance. That's a recipe for disaster.
Well, let me just give you some of these facts. Now, this is since Obamacare has not even fully enacted yet.
Right.
Hasn't fully enacted
right.
yet.
You know,
okay.
People don't
now,
realize it comes in stages every year. New.
In 2012, over $4 billion, the states that have enacted Obamacare have saved.
Right.
That's, of course, the United States. Premiums in states that have exchanges have fallen, the premiums have fallen. And in 9 states, they have fallen below what the estimates were.
Right.
Increases in the costs have dropped.
Right.
The insurance premiums have dropped. this is not according to me or Joe Blow out in the street. This is according to Price Waterhouse, who's been certified to check all the premiums. And increases in the cost of these premiums, as I said before, have slowed. But in October 1st, 30 million people will be eligible to get health care by state exchanges.
Right.
30 million!
Instantly! So, again, unless they're being blocked by a blockhead, they're going to get help. And the help is going to better their lives, and the costs across the board are going to drop.
Well, I tell you what.
It's almost as if it's a functioning, affordable health care system.
A functioning, affordable health care system.
Hmm.
Well, we are going to change up a little bit on this right now because it's time for... A little bit of talk about if you got yourself a gun. And on the line with us right now is a film critic extraordinaire, Big Gaff. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay, I'm here.
How you doing, Gaff?
All right.
So tell me, you're 260 pounds, and you're over in Italy, having a wonderful time, and you get a heart attack. Now,
there's nothing surprising there.
Nothing's right, but hey, we've been talking about this for years, George and I. You know, it seems like everybody we went to school with is dropping around us. Is that right, George?
It's unbelievable. You can't go 2 weeks without somebody.
I'm telling you, we just had a young man, was it a month ago? That just passed?
Just less than a month.
Yeah. Unbelievable. So, was this a shock to you? Were you shocked to hear it or what? As a film critic?
No, because first of all, James Gandolfini was not really a film person. Television made him. He appears in movies, but he was not a movie person. If you look on his movieography, you don't see the only thing I could really come up with that I thought he was really big in and special in was The Castle, a picture with Robert Redford, where Robert Redford was a general who had been sentenced to a military prison. And Gandolfini was the warden of the commanding officer of that post of the prison.
I don't remember seeing that.
Well, you just spoke volumes about my point. I'm telling you the most memorable thing I can think of, and you haven't seen it or heard about it. Yeah, he made this film with Redford over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was a very good film in the sense that what happened was Redford was a hero. He was in prison. But he was in a prison for being heroic. What he had done is he had refused, when given orders as a general, when given orders to evacuate some position in the Middle East, I think. I'm not sure of the details. But he wouldn't leave his men behind. Mm-hmm. He refused to leave men behind. And so the men loved him, but command had to put him in jail because he disobeyed a direct order. But he was a hero to the soldiers, so he was admired by all the soldiers. But the Pentagon had to put him in, had to show that even a general can't disobey orders. So Gandolfini was the warden. He was like a colonel, but he had never served in combat. So what happened was he tried to, he wanted to have Redford come have breakfast with him and everything like that. He wanted to you know, get ingratiate himself to this national hero. So he played up the Redford, and then he kept this Gandolfini kept this chess, this diorama on his desk, on his in his office, where he had military battles. So like he would have, let's say he had Gettysburg there and all this stuff like that, but he'd also have the, you know, the Battle of the Bulge and things like that. So anyway, he would talk about these battles to any junior officers that came in, and he'd talk about, you know, this and that. And Redford got there, and one of the junior officers said, oh, Colonel so-and-so is a real military man. And this is the key line in the whole story. Redford said, a real soldier wouldn't talk about these battles. A man who sat there with blood and guts all around him does not go back and reflect on that as a conversation piece at lunchtime. He said, "You, if you've been swimming in blood and you've seen your best friend get his head blown off, this is not something you talk about when you have with the waiting for the basketball game to start." So he said he's not a combat soldier. He said a combat soldier would never talk about this stuff and glorify it, because anybody that was there knows it wasn't pleasant. It wasn't something people that weren't there would talk about it. He said people who were there don't talk about the things he talks about. And that was the key thing. And so they had a constant Gandolfini overheard Redford say that. So after that, Redford became his enemy, and he tried to break Redford, you know, and show the men in the at the prison that he was tougher than Redford. And I don't have to tell you who won that battle.
Well, you know, I was just looking here at his demography, and you're right. I mean, they got, you know, some big name, some not so big name movies, but you know, with True Romance, Terminal Velocity, Crimson Tide.
He was always like the third.
He was a supporting actor.
But he was a good supporting actor. I remember in the.
He was a fine actor. I'm just saying that, you know, he's second banana. But he was fine. I mean, he was an excellent actor, but The Sopranos is what gave the TV is what gave him a chance to shine.
Right.
You know, to put
right.
him in the front and get in the lead. So, you know, his thing is his real contribution is television, because that's where he. He was in a groundbreaking show, and he was the perfect person for the part. And, you know, you really felt this guy was Tony Soprano. I mean, he had a range of emotions.
Oh, yeah. I want you to listen. Just James Lipton was talking about what he thought of Tony.
He made it look easy. All great actors make it look easy. And he made it look easy. People thought, oh, well, that's James Gandolfini. He's not acting. Yes, he was. And he was acting brilliantly.
And the thing is that when Tony Soprano, this was supposed to be, David Chase said originally, this was supposed to be a comedy drama.
Yeah.
But Gandolfini is the one who changed it to drama, even though there was plenty of times when you would laugh out loud.
A comic moment.
Right. But he made it, he made himself the serious person with the multifaceted sides.
Yeah.
I mean, and
that's one of the things I thought was done best, was instead of being the cardboard cutout gangster that we've always seen. And this guy, you know, he had serious problems. He had serious doubts. He had serious emotional and everything else problems, family, everything. You know, everything inside is falling down, but on the outside, he's the successful mobster. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, this is the who's the one that said that? Hyman Rush said, "This is the business we have chosen."
Yeah, this is the life we've chosen. Yeah.
That's right.
But
so
the thing, Thomas, I'm cutting you off, Mikey, but. The thing that Thomas said about when he mentioned the fact that the show brought in his family. I mean, you're sitting up there, he's ordering a hit on somebody, and then the next minute his wife is telling him that they got to go to the PTA meeting. You know,
right.
That had never been done before like that.
Right.
You know, he had
Absolutely.
To worry about the PTA meeting, and yet he's just called somebody to be killed, and he's worrying about the PTA meeting because, you know, he's supposed to go and show up.
Yeah, or even the horror of half the time the people he was dealing with or having to take care of were friends or families or associate members. You
That's
know?
Right.
And it was kind of like, hey, sorry, but you know you messed up, and now I got to kill you. What are you going to tell? What are you going to tell my cousin? Well, sorry, you know.
He was more. Tony Soprano was more on the order of Don Corleone than Michael Corleone. Michael Corleone, the family was really second all the time if he got to it. Remember what, one thing I remember what Don Corleone said about Sonny. He said that if you're not good to your family, you're not good.
You can't be a real man.
You can't be a real man.
You can't be a real man.
You can't be a real man. And Michael Corleone did not do that. He was strict. I mean, he on the surface he was, but the most important thing was you know, I want to get all I don't want to get rid of all my enemies. I just want to get rid of some. You know, the thing is that what's the name? The Tony Soprano. He really had a major problem. That's why he had to go to a psychiatrist, because he was being pulled. And you know, I don't believe deep down inside he ever wanted to do this. I think it came from his father or some or his uncle, that they brought him into this business because he devoted too much time. I mean, it was like when he went inside, I mean, into the house, he was getting beat up. Everybody was giving him orders.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like a...
it was not like anybody else in the world. He had the crappiest job in the world he had to go to. It's what he did. He didn't like it.
Right.
He didn't enjoy it. You know, kind of hated it the whole way. But he was good at it. He was successful at it. You know, so he could afford the home and everything else.
Right.
Well, while everybody's like, yo, they'd be like, give us more.
Yeah.
Like,
what was that? They accepted it. That's right. Well, listen, I want to hear you. I want to play this one scene for you. Listen to this.
You're the mafia. Am I the what? Whatever you want to call it.
That I've lived in the house all my life. I've seen police come with warrants. I've seen you going out at 3 in the morning.
So you never seen Doc Cusimano go out at 3 in the morning on a call?
Because the Cusimano kids ever find $50,000 in boomerangs and a 45 automatic while they're hunting for Easter eggs?
They're becoming aware.
Right.
Not just the trash guy.
But she was already aware. She just wanted him to admit it.
Right, right. Tell me the truth.
Tell me the truth. You know, but so these are the things he said, no, I don't want them to think of me like this.
Right.
I don't want them. And you remember when...
He didn't want to be a little suburbia guy.
That's right. You remember when she was trying to get into the college there was somebody there that found out who he was, didn't want the daughter to come in, and the mother went up to the college.
Right.
And the thing was that... He came home, and there was another story every day after shooting 3 people, strangling 3 people, putting them in the dumpster, crushing them, and then trying to make sure that he don't get whacked by his mother. I mean, you know, now he's got to go home and he's got to eat a humble pie.
That's one of my favorite scenes of all, the iconic moments. And every day, like his little 5 minutes of bliss, he'd walk down to the end of the driveway
and get the newspaper.
He had to be a normal guy, because the rest of the day he's like putting people through, literally through the sausage grinder over at the diner or whatever, you know.
So then we have to look at George is the thing that before Tony Soprano, every person that was the protagonist was good. I mean, they didn't have a bad side. I think the only one that I think that ever had a bad side was Paladin. He was a hitman, but he dressed up nice and went out with women and played cards. And, you know, he was the only one that they showed, but he really wasn't bad. Paladin didn't go out and just kill people. He went out to get people who were acting bad.
Oh, that's kind of like saying
he was a bounty hunter.
The saint.
Right. But Tony Soprano was bad.
Yeah, he was truly bad.
I mean, he was truly bad. And yet, every time he came home, we started pulling for him.
Yeah.
Man, why did they leave Tony alone?
Well, the other thing, what I thought was groundbreaking thing for a TV show like this and stuff in the gangster movie and stuff like that was when he ran into Charles S. Dutton. When Charles Dutton was the I forgot where he was now. He was the was he a school crossing guard? He was something.
Yes.
I forgot what his position was. It wasn't a big thing. It was like he was a bus driver, school crossing guard or something. But Tony felt that he should be treated. I think he had done some favor for the kids. And he always appreciated that this school, this black school crossing guard or whatever he was, I can't remember, but it wasn't a big position. But he had done something, I think, good for the kids at some point. He did something to help the kids out. That was such a thing. He wanted to protect this man. He wanted to see that this man was rewarded for his thing. It wasn't a race thing. I mean, that was very good, I thought, to show that he admired the man for what he did, was a black guy that did something. You give him $10 and let him go.
They were going to fire Dutton, weren't they?
What was it?
I think they were going to fire Dutton also.
He was going to get let go of his job. And I don't remember what it was. It wasn't a powerful position. He wasn't like a city councilman. He was like a school crossing guard, a custodian at the school. Right. He was something that wasn't. He wasn't in a power position, and they were just going to lop him off. Tony made moves to keep him in his position or something.
Right, absolutely. Because I think his son was going to the school. Because I think Meadow was already a little bit huge in high school or something. Because that was elementary school or junior high school or something.
Yeah.
But here's another little clip I'd like you to hear. And this is Tony Gets Analysis.
Remember something about this show. I think one of the masterstrokes of The Sopranos was that he went into analysis. What did the analysis do? It is the precise equivalent of the Shakespearean soliloquy. It allows us to listen to his thoughts. That, I thought, was the most brilliant thing of all the brilliant things that David Chase did. When he sat down in front of his analysts and began to talk, we were literally listening to the equivalent of the Shakespearean soliloquy.
So what do you think about that, George?
Well, the thing I thought of was that when he went into analysis was, this guy could have got killed for going into analysis. I mean, that's a plot in several gangster pictures that you can't, you can't go in there. Matter of fact, I saw one picture where they wouldn't let a guy get, he couldn't go to the dentist. They was going to use the laughing gas.
Laughing gas.
Because it makes you talk.
Right,
laughing gas, maybe. When you're going under, you start talking, babbling about things and stuff like that. And they didn't.
Well,
I mean, there was a picture where they're going to shoot a guy if they told him if he went under the noxious. I can't say it now.
The thing is, you better act like this. You. You're something you know. No. You know. Remember, I mean, how secretive they were. They had to kidnap the damn court therapist and bring him. The first time they went into his office, interrupted his office, told the guy to get out. And he says, you're not working for Mr. Kitty. He said, you can't talk. No, I don't talk. You won't talk. No, I won't talk. No, you can't talk. I know. He said, you. So analysis was a major thing because nobody knew Tony was going there until his right-hand man found out about it.
Her notes would be his death thing. I mean, if she wrote down Tony feels guilty about the three guys he killed last week and had killed last week in Union City, New Jersey, even if it's not legally thing, I mean, if just that they could see his notes and know what he did, FBI or the other gangsters or something like that, if they got hold of her notes, didn't have to talk to her or anything.
She said, the notes are private. Well, we know nothing is private now. Nothing to General Keith Alexander. But then let me tell you one other thing. The thing that I liked about it was where they had the horrible uncle who taught Tony everything.
Uncle Junior.
He goes wacko and shoots him. And no, but he wasn't behind it. It was his own mother.
Right.
I mean, you know, here's a short scene in the hospital where she's got an oxygen mask on and Tony's trying to tell her, I know you did it.
Yeah.
I know you did it. Just listen to this. Because she's got actually getting ready, she had a heart attack, and she's getting ready to die. And Tony say, "Yeah, Ma, I know about it. You're trying to have me what?" and this is his mother. So you know he.
Who
can he trust? I mean, his uncle, his mother. There's a hitman out there. I mean, what the heck?
Yeah.
I mean, he, in being who he is, was the personification of creating Dexter, was the personification of creating Justified. There's a lot of characters now that have this little evil in them. And as James Lipton said,
it's true. It's one of the most attractive qualities that a person can have. We like to know that someone is vulnerable, that someone is evil. Why? Because we're vulnerable and evil.
Yeah. So, because we're all vulnerable and evil. So it created. And they left you. Chase left you at the end of every episode. I mean, but holy cow. The stuff is piling up. And you know, it was on with 10 years, 9, 10 years. Every episode, there was more weight put on his shoulders.
Yeah. So you can just see the pressure.
And I don't know. I think there was more weight put on from the family side than the other side. What do you think, Judge?
Oh, yeah. Well, the family thing was, you know, it's like you said when you started off, the thing about the Godfather thing, if you don't take care of your family, you can't really be a man. You know, I think that the family thing, he couldn't ignore. I mean, like I said before, he had to deal with the PTA meetings, and he had to deal with the, you know, church things and stuff like that, and worry about Meadow and who she's going out with, and Anthony, and what was his son, Anthony? Was
yeah,
Tony
Anthony.
Too?
Yeah,
Anthony was smoking,
I don't know if he was smoking crack or just, you know, weed, but he was doing that, and you know, he was doing that in real life. But
even the underlings, all of his crew, they were also messed
and
up.
Then,
you know, he was always having to put out fires that they caused back.
And then when you have to kill pussy, I mean, you really know things are bad.
Yeah.
He never recovered from that. That was I never felt he recovered from that. I could never believe he would get to that point.
Yeah.
That he would go to do this. I mean, that there couldn't be some arrangement worked out or something like that. I could not believe that when he did that. That was, I mean, that brought back a new intensity that, you know, maybe it was a focus, people, because, you know, like you said, with all the domestic things, you were looking at, you know, instead of worrying about if he's going to, you know, take over something in Las Vegas or something, what we were trying to figure out was, is he going to be able to go to Meadow's graduation? Is the teacher going to pass her in the class? You know, we were getting wrapped up with all that stuff, but when he killed his best friend, it goes back to childhood. That was more than a brother to him. This man was more than a brother.
Yeah.
So that was really, to me, that was like, wow, you know, we are dealing with a gangster. You know what I mean? You start to lose sight of that.
But there was for some of the people who don't really remember that, tell us why he had to kill him.
I'm trying to remember, too, I think they got him to inform or they created, right. the FBI got him to inform, or they created the illusion that he informed more than he was. And I know they were doing it out. They were taping him or something out on the boat. He would go out on his boat to get away from phones and surveillance or something.
Right.
When they finally found out, they had no choice but to kill him.
Right. And then you're, well, who's left? But his wacky sister.
Yeah. Oh, that sister.
I mean, he had there never could be, he could always get rid of the problems in the gangster world, wipe them out, get rid of them, but you can't get rid of your family.
Yeah. Well, look, from his mom to his sister, they were the epitome of dysfunction all the way.
Golly.
That's why he was in
there. That sister killed her husband without a word. She stuck a knife in him, I think. When she killed her husband, remember they were arguing at the table, and she just whacked him. She just stabbed him or something. Whatever she did, just killed him. I mean, that was, wow. You know, these Sopranos weren't joking. This is a sister doing this.
That's right.
She, that shows you that these are not just, people who innocently got involved in a little shoplifting. These people were hardcore. This is the sister.
And she was worse.
She wiped him out.
That's right. She was worse than Tony. Because every time Tony did something like that, you saw, I think, a notch of his humanity disappear.
There was remorse on some of the things he did.
That's right.
He had a sense of remorse or something. She killed that man. She didn't have any conversation. She came through the door and killed him.
And Tony couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
He said, what the?
Yeah.
What?
But then he's got to fix that, too.
Yeah, then I have to fix that. I mean, so there were so many things.
There were so many things twisted in this thing. Because, I mean, like, for me, one of the most horrific scenes ever was putting the guy through the meat grinder in the deli. But it was their own deli, their friends and family deli, that they all go and eat all the time. And they're grinding bodies in the back. You know what I mean? I was just like, oh, my God. It horrified me so bad. I almost couldn't eat deli meat for about a month. I was just thinking about it.
No hamburger. Where's that hamburger coming from?
Like Thomas Stewart, Thomas pointed out, that when you can disassociate yourself from what you're doing to that degree, you know what I mean? When you can just do these horrible things and then turn around and tell somebody that their suit looks nice, or there's no remorse in there. It's just they can just turn it on and turn it off and go about their business. And that deli grinding up thing that we just put the guy through the grinder and got rid of him that way is just like, this isn't something you think you've agonized about this for all your life. There was no. Two minutes later, we were fine.
They're kind of monsters.
And we're just looking at a clip on the cycle now of the Sopranos, as like one of the first years. He was thin. And, he told David Chase, I got to be the boss. I got to be the big boss. I got to look like I'm the big boss.
Yeah.
So he really put on a lot of his weight to make it more like a Soprano.
Yeah, look like a big successful.
Look like a big successful, guys living in I forget where he was supposed to be living at in Jersey, but.
I thought it was funny. I was looking on his all his backup roles, different things, and one of them, the man who wasn't there, he played a little character called Big Dave Brewster. But I'm just thinking, that just kind of like, just perfectly fits his character.
Right. Well, Leon Panetta, who he played in Zero Dark 30, said that he did a fabulous role. He did a fabulous acting role.
I know he didn't do many, movie or film roles, big roles, but he was my secret hope for a political movie in the future. I thought he would have been perfect for us. And tell me if I'm wrong, but I was always hoping somebody would do a biopic on Scalia to show it was. And he did in that court, what he, because this guy has been a real lightning rod on the court.
Oh, absolutely.
But
right.
If you look at the look of Scalia.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Another
kind
of Italian, dumpy, guy, he would have been perfect for that. I was hoping somebody would do a Soprano, Gandolfini as Scalia.
Now, who's the guy, George, or Thomas, I can't remember, was one of his, either the first or second man that was with the white hair. What was his name?
On his crew.
On his crew.
Yeah, he was the one that was kind of better than the
other.
Yeah, he had the problem with the mother. He lived with his mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I can't remember now. I can't. Okay. I know who you're talking about.
Here's a, Tony has talked to him one time about taking orders and who not to whack. I think they were talking about killing the guy who they saw in the gay bar or the gay nightclub. Remember that? And they wanted to whack him.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this is a short scene with Tony's addressing that to him. It's very short, so you got to listen.
Lay your hand on him, and you're going to answer to me. If you can quote the rules, you can obey him. You hear me?
He said, if you can quote the orders, you can obey him. If you harm him, you got to answer to me. Because Tony was shocked, too. But surely Tony wasn't going to kill him.
No,
that was the big, round, fat guy that disappeared into Jersey someplace, and he found some girl.
Paulie?
No, Paulie was the guy he was dressing to. Right, that was
right.
Paulie. That was Paulie. But who was the short, Silvio, round guy?
Silvio, Dante, Paulie, Dolly Terry, Salvatore, Big Pussy.
I think it was Salvatore.
Was Big Pussy.
Yeah, no, huh?
And then,
oh, okay.
I'm just trying to look at these other...
Who's the one that was gay and that went away in Jersey? And for a long time, he left his wife. He left, huh? Oh, yeah. But he left his wife. He left everything behind because he was gay and because he knew he would be whacked. And he said, well.
Walnuts had the white hair on the side.
Okay, then, yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
The other guy had snow white hair, right?
But no, I'm talking about the guy, Harvey Wallace, who's the guy just here inside.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
but I believe that the Sopranos as a storyline, as gangsters, was the first look. And you know, I can't remember who's the one that said that you know, gangsters got families too.
Yeah.
You know, so is this their way out? Because they can boss and kill people and everything else and go home. They're, you know, they're not like Michael Corleone, who goes home and he's still Michael Corleone.
Yeah.
Don Corleone, when he went home, you always heard him say yes to his wife. And he played with the grandkids.
But, you know, this parallel they make, Mikey, is always this. The guy who's running some upright drug company or something, I mean a legitimate drug company, who knows he's putting something on the market that's really got some ingredient that's going to hurt the public. The bankers that had made those housing mortgage loans that they knew the people couldn't pay off and things like that. You know what I mean? It's the gang, and the Godfather brought that out, Marlon Brando, that, you know, you're the gangster that's doing this thing, and these guys are better gangsters than we are. Because they're doing, you know, these corporate presidents and things like that are running these illegal scams. I tell you the truth, these Tea Party Republicans are gangsters.
No, absolutely.
They're trying to beat everybody. You know, they're gangsters too. So, I mean, it's just the status of gangsters or something, where you stand in the gangster community.
Well, it's absolutely true because... Well, and what you just said is absolutely true, because there's a Republican, Stephen Fincher, who's on the oversight committee for the farm bill. He said that we need to cut the SNAP program another 12%. They already cut it $20 billion. And they said that it's outrageous that they're getting paid $31.50 a week.
Yeah.
He said that is too much money for these people who don't work to live on. So he had his assistant, Chambers, for a whole week, lived on $31.50. And Chambers says, I did great. I had wonderful. And I had enough money left over. If I was a child, I could get into the movies with the money I had left over.
Yeah.
He said, because I only spent $27.58. So we need to cut that $31.50 another 20% down to $27.58 That's what needs to be cut. Now, these people, now, the reason why I'm telling you that is the background, because Fincher, this guy Steve Fincher, is one of the 15 members of the House and spouses that last year got $237,921 in taxpayer subsidies through having a farm. He's one of the people. And he voted down the Democratic amendment that would take away all subsidies to these farmers who got over an average of $1 million a year. So when they voted that down, they said, okay, let's cut out the premiums for it at least. They voted that down. They said, we can't afford to have that cut.
Yeah.
But yet they can afford to cut a person on the SNAP program 12% down to, $27.58. I spend that before I go out my door.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, we can talk about these guys all day long. I mean, what we had under the Gingrich Congress when they were in there literally turning the cameras away while they were intimidating members from the floor during votes. And they, Boehner, you know, almost lost his job for walking around handing out tobacco money to everybody on the floor, which is blatantly illegal. But, I mean, these, you know, these guys just act like mobsters. They really do. You know, and somebody once said the difference between mobsters and the bankers is that, you know, mobsters make millions, but the bankers make trillions. You know?
Yeah. So. Well, in the original Scarface movie, they did something in there which established the fact that all the stuff the gangsters do is just the little stuff. You know, it's like they're running around selling drugs, selling alcohol, doing this and that, robbing someplace. And all that stuff is small potatoes because they showed that there was a hierarchy in the Anglo-Saxon Christian community that was so high above them that, like, they were just like, it's like you with the paper boy. You know, like, I don't deal with the paper boys. Like, all these mobsters and stuff like that was just like paper boys. To the, you know, they couldn't even mention the name of the people who were really running things.
Yeah,
there's
absolutely.
A great scene in the movie.
Hello?
He dropped.
Oh, well,
no. Yeah, he dropped. So you need to call back. Let me just.
Answering that here. I mean,
but what he was talking about, what George was talking about, is very important because the Attorney General Schneiderman from New York State is getting ready to sue Wells Fargo and Bank of America again for violating the national mortgage settlement that they agreed to,
which was their fix. Or their punishment for violating all the mortgages the first time.
That's right. And they
violating their own, punishment for their other crimes, is what you're saying.
Absolutely true. So the thing was that they were supposed to, as part of the mortgage settlement, there was four things that they were supposed to do. One of them was to set up timelines to process mortgages and modifications. Let's get to George back up here.
My phone went dead on me or something.
What you were saying is absolutely true, because when we talk, I don't know if you saw Attorney General Schneiderman from New York State. He's getting ready to sue again Wells Fargo and Bank of America for violating the National Mortgage Settlement Act, getting ready to what did I say?
I said that one of those amendments to the GOP, we're watching the news, people, sorry, but one of the amendments the GOP had up incentivized throwing people off the SNAP.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
So this is, again, these things they were putting in there. So not only are they hurting people,
poison pill.
Yeah, but not only are they hurting people, they're
they're trying to make it profitable and beneficial to companies that hurt people.
Right. And you remember it now, because all it was, two tracks, but the tracks are the same way. And the one of the, and I can't remember what storyline it was with the Sopranos. I think it was Meadow who was working with the poor, right? With the poor kids. And she was talking about this.
Yeah.
And Tony believed it. It was I think it was Meadow's mother who didn't believe it. She had put it in because Tony had come from poor background, and the mother did too. But she pushed it out of her mind. She had forgotten about it. But Tony didn't want her, Meadow, to get involved with these kids because he thought, well, drugs. But that was one of the things that Meadow said, no, that they are not the problem, it was the government. Okay? And so General Snyder said that there were three, particularly, that these national settlements, that the national settlement included, and is a timeline thanks to process the modification of applications. Because what they would do is, if while you they were modifying your modification for your loan, you were still being charged not being able to pay, violation for not being able to pay on your mortgage. So maybe when you went in, you owed $50,000, and they would charge you $100 a week for not paying it because you couldn't have a job. They were not supposed to charge you that $100 a week while they were modifying it. So, but they were still charging you it, and instead of doing it in 1 week, they were taking 4 months to do it.
Right.
So what they wanted to do, they want people to foreclose because the banks make more money when you foreclose than if you don't foreclose. They don't care about that because what they'll do is they'll take the foreclosure money and they'll sell that house and everything else and they'll make more money on it.
Yep.
So what Snyderman said he's going to do is to pass a bill as the Attorney General, not pass a bill, but make it illegal for banks to foreclose.
You know, Mike,
so what do you think about that?
We want to protect the consumer. We don't want that in this country.
We don't want
to help citizens. I mean, come on.
Democrats are in control of the state and no deal.
Only thing we care about is corporations and profits.
So, I mean, what do you think about that, George?
Well, listen, I can't think about anything because what I'm trying to figure out is this. How can the Republicans make a passionate crusade out of the fact that millionaires and billionaires would have to pay more taxes, but they can also turn around then and be passionate that poor people shouldn't get health care. I don't understand how you can do those two things. I'm worried about people who don't have, in other words, they're worried about you can't order a second dessert, and they're not worried about people who haven't eaten. You know, they don't care about they disregard the people who haven't eaten, but they want to, but they'll cry. The rich guy can't have two desserts. He only got to have chocolate cake. He did not get a piece of pie. I don't understand that. They're thinking, I mean, anybody that can think like that is so far gone. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like you said, for a guy to pretend that he lived on $27. He lived on $27 after his wife came and picked him up when he called her on the cell phone to take him to lunch and, you know, and stuff like that.
Right.
You know, that's how he lived on the $27. You know, so, it's just a sickness. I mean, it's beyond surreal. It's just, I don't know how you do it. How can you make a passion? I mean, you can make a financial argument about taxing billionaires. You know, well, you know, they've already paid taxes on the way up the scale and so on. You can make a financial argument if you want to. But how do they make a passionate thing? Like Romney and them, they made out like it was a crusade to help the poor little rich people. You know, they won't be able to vacation three times a year in St. Thomas if we raise their taxes.
They'll only be able to vacation twice there. They won't be able to get a Lamborghini. They'll have to just drive a Cadillac.
Oh, my God.
You're dealing with insanity, so.
Like my next door neighbor, Ned. He's got four cars. He's got a Porsche, a 1990, the big Porsche, fire engine red in the garage. He next to that, he has a classic. I think it's a 1970 convertible. What do you call it? Mercedes. I think it's a 450 convertible. Then outside, he has a 2013 Lexus with the plush soft Corinthian leather and wood around the
inlay. Right.
Scared to drive any of them because it might get
damaged. And he couldn't. He said, I can't drive this car every day. So he said, I have to get another car. So he bought a 2011 to drive every day. So I said, Ned, what happens, you know, when these cars break down, I guess you'll have to start driving because the Porsche and the Mercedes both have the same mileage on it, 63,000 miles. And he says, so what happened was he had a problem with the 2011 Lexus. So I said, oh, I guess you have to take out one of these. Why don't you take out the Porsche? He said, oh, no, I'm renting a car. He rented a car.
So that he wouldn't put in.
I mean, so this is the mentality. They don't think like someone. And you go to his refrigerator. He has one stick of butter. That's it. And so on. One stick of butter. Because he eats out breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah.
If he wants a snack, he goes out.
Well, if I can cut in on you. When they opened Trump Tower, the reporter from New York, Jim Jensen, sent out somebody to do the field work. Jim Jensen was the anchor man. He sent out somebody to do the field work, and they visited Trump Tower. And they were taken on a tour. And they couldn't take them to the $8 million apartment, $8 million a year rent. This is not condos, this is rent. $8 million a year, they were sold out. So they took them to a $5.5 million apartment. So the reporters going around looking at everything. When they got to the kitchen, the reporters looked at the guy giving them the tour, one of Trump's underlings, and he said, you know, I pay $400 a month, and I got a bigger kitchen than this. And the guy looked at him and he said what you just said. He said, that's because you cook. He said, these people will never set foot in this kitchen. He said, they come in here for ice cream, for popcorn, coffee, and toast. That's the only five things that they'll ever set foot in this kitchen for. He said, they have their food brought in, they go out, or they have somebody come in and cook for them. But they don't come into the kitchen, and there's people who live here who couldn't tell you where the kitchen is.
Right.
He said, why should they? He said, if they're not getting, unless they want some popcorn or ice coffee, he said, that's it. They don't know where the kitchen is. You know?
Well, I said, Ned, he has an ice maker in there. I said, Ned, have you ever done? He said, oh yeah, I empty out the ice trays once a month. Because, you know, I don't want stale ice.
Stale ice.
So the thing is, so he had his complete backyard redone with a 30 by 20 foot swimming pool. Inlaid.
Waterfalls.
Holds 10 people. It's a hot tub. It empties into the swimming pool. The swimming pool has the lights on, and he has music that he had put in that goes with the color, different color lights, and he has he put out an arbor out there with a full kitchen, and I said, well, you know, Ned, you have to learn how to use this stove that you have out here. under the arbor.
It's a massive grill out there with Roman columns around.
Right. It's a massive grill. And he said, oh, I've never used it before. I don't know how to cook.
Yeah.
I said, well, so he didn't have the
so he put it in for a pairing.
Yeah. So I said, well, Ned, you know, you need gas for this. So I need gas for it? He said, but it's electric. I said, you see any wires connected to it? It's electric. You turn it on, and it works electrically, but it's gas. So anyway, so we had to go in, and I said, do you have a pot? He had four pots in the place. You know, he got the standard size. It must have been something that he got in the he went to Walmart.
Or somebody gave him a gift.
Yeah, so I said, have you ever used a stove? He says, he has never used his stove.
Oh,
he's been living there 15 years.
He's lucky he didn't blow the house up when he turned it on.
So I said, Ned, I'm going to show you how to cook beans. and he said, that's easy. I said, yeah, but Ned, you have a can opener? He said, can opener. Can opener. What does it look like? I said, it looks like this. I had a manual can opener. He said, yes, I got one of them around here somewhere. So we looked at all the doors and we found one. So the thing is, how can you imagine someone like that who's innocent because they don't know any better? Imagine living on $31.50. Now,
Having change.
That's right.
He lived on $27 and something.
That's right. So the thing now, I
would have been rich.
Yeah.
So I said, no, he got $31.50, but he only spent $27.58 for the week. So I can understand Neb not knowing that, but this is a guy who did not want someone to stay with getting $31.50, wanted to cut it 12%, but that 12% they were cutting was going to go to him for subsidizing his farm so he wouldn't grow whatever he's supposed to grow.
Right.
I mean, so these are completely different people.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole world of difference between a guy who's manipulating the system,
right,
and literally stealing from the poor to stuff his coffers, and somebody like Ned. Now, not to we leave out your neighbor and his name and all this, but to pick on the guy, he is just himself.
Yeah,
he doesn't understand the world. People like that though illuminate perfectly the problem, the disconnect between the haves and have-nots, because this guy would have no conception whatsoever. And not just to name your neighbor, but any of these same people. They cannot comprehend someone that is eating, day to day, paycheck to paycheck, trying to survive and having to do for themselves. They couldn't comprehend it.
That's
at
right.
All. This is a guy who has five cars, can't find one to drive, and has to rent one.
Right.
What I mean? So you don't have a conception of having one broken down car for the entire family trying to get around on, and then when the belt breaks on it, you can't even afford it, and your walks, and you can't feed your child that week or whatever. These are different universes.
And
that's why they don't.
Well, have either one of you seen the Queen of Versailles? It's a TV show. It's about the family, what is it, the Siegel family. The people owned all these timeshare things. They were they were big, and the husband was big in timeshares. And they're the people who are trying to build the biggest house in the history of America. It's supposed to be, it's bigger than the White House. It's the one that's supposed to be modeled on the Palace of Versailles. And their thing was how they want to have 25 bedrooms and 25 master bedrooms and 30 bathrooms and a baseball field, their own baseball, not a tennis court and stuff. They got that. They want to have a baseball field at their house.
Yeah, well, this is the guy largest timeshare or corporation in the world. It's in Florida,
yeah,
right?
Whatever the timeshare, the timeshare thing in Florida. It went broke, and they can't finish the house, but they were building the biggest house in America at 90,000 square feet. 90,000 square feet. In other words, they could have a football game in their living room or something. They showed a woman, they said that somebody came to look at the house They didn't get it finished because they went broke before they went got finished. But they said that somebody came and said, "Oh, your living room is gigantic." She said, "This is my wardrobe. This is my closet."
That was her closet.
They
said yes,
this was her living room at this place. This was her closet.
That was her closet. And what happened
was
they stopped building the house 5 years, but then they got the money back and they're rebuilding it now. See, they didn't go broke. That's right. They didn't go broke.
Well, no, they went broke for they went broke for them. They didn't go broke for us.
Right. So they didn't go broke for us. They went broke for them.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
like,
what broke for them was we can't afford the 35th bathroom.
Right. Right. So they had to stop until he got it. So as he is he's the president. And see, Wyndham, the president of Wyndham, or what? It's the largest.
No, he wasn't Wyndham. I don't think it was the other thing. Wyndham
was
still functioning. His thing was something else, but they were like, they were right up there with Wyndham.
Wyndham
is a Las Vegas guy. Wyndham is a Steve, what's his name? In Las Vegas is Wyndham.
Yeah, okay,
Steve Wyndham. Wyndham is Steve Wynn in Las Vegas. But this is the other guy who's like his number one challenger. And he got caught up in the thing and went broke. And again, when I say broke, I don't mean that. They're not standing on the corner asking for change.
But he might be standing on the court asking for change. He goes, "Yeah, I wouldn't put it past him, even though he's got the money."
Yeah, this is crazy as bedbugs. I'm telling you, they have no sense of decency. You know, that was the thing when I went to see The Great Gatsby. I said that the people didn't spend a dime to help anybody in the whole picture.
Right.
These people spent money on everything, but they never gave anybody a tip. You never saw them give the waiter a tip or something. They never let go a dime that was for anybody else's benefit except their own.
And
you're supposed to care about them. You're supposed to worry about, oh, they're not happy. I didn't even give a crap if they all got swallowed by a tornado. It wouldn't bother me a bit.
Now, you tell them giving people a tip, you know, in the guys are getting ready to rob the bank. They're sitting around in the diner, and they're going to give a tip. And he says, "No, I don't tip."
Oh yeah, what's the Reservoir Dogs?
Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs.
Well,
yeah,
I said
Tarantino. Mr. Pink didn't tip. He said, "I don't tip." And the other guys explained to him, they said, well, waitresses, they work hard, and they have to work hard, they try to support their families, and a waitress is a job that a woman can get, and they depend on their tips, their minimum wage, and they depend on the tips to have a living wage, to make it a living wage. And then he starts playing a little fiddle, says, "I'll play the world's smallest violin." He says, "If you want me to cry, I'll cry, but if you want me to reach in my pocket and give them money, I'm not going to do it."
Yeah, well, and then he says some expletives to Mr. Pink. He says,
"Yeah, Steve Buscemi." And then Lawrence Kinney comes along and says that you better kick in the money. You know, kick in the. They were supposed to just tip a dollar. He said, "Pay the money because I paid for your breakfast." And the guy, and then Steve Buscemi says, "Well, since you paid for breakfast, I'll do it. But normally, I don't tip anybody." And they're going out to rob, like you said, they're going out to rob hundreds of thousands of dollars in a few minutes. And he couldn't see giving somebody a dollar tip.
That's one of the greatest opening scenes of any movie
I have ever
seen.
Yeah, but listen, this, Israel, look, when I was down in Mississippi, you know, before I escaped
Mississippi.
To America.
Oh.
But when I was going to school, a lot of my friends, you know, the girls there and all that were waitresses and worked in the local restaurants around the college. You know, that's what you did for jobs. All the young guys, you know, I even worked in a bar one time as a freaking bouncer. You know, imagine that. But the girls there had these just horror stories, and I used to go in there with them. You know, we would go sometimes and eat at the restaurant of whatever your friends, where they worked, you know, go and do things like this.
they had groups all the time come in. The worst were they would have groups come from the churches, those mega churches down there, and these pastors would come in with, you know, 35, 45 of their congregation, sit down on these massive tables, eat their Sunday lunch, and get up and leave. And they had these cards down there that were folded over and looked like $20 bill or something. So it's just a card, and when you open it up, it says, here's your tip for the day, pray to Jesus. You know, and they took those things seriously. They're serious, no tips at all. And they used to be so angry because they said the worst tippers of all were those the church groups and stuff. They would never tip money. But they'd give them things like, you know, you should pray.
Well, they didn't have any money because all the money was going to that daggone preacher.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
That's why he was taking them out.
These people are, like, struggling to live, and they literally were getting paid less than minimum wage. You know, so when you don't tip them, you're making them starve, man.
It is.
I just can't believe the greed of some people, you know.
Well.
Like, how's it going to hurt you to give a few pennies to somebody when they're doing their job?
Well, the thing is that when you have people in the Progressive Party that think like this, just listen, we'll tell you, this is the reason why it's like that.
Begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. The incidence of rape and resulting in pregnancy are very low.
Now,
don't get me started on that again.
If you dare to think that is amazing, you need to hear this.
Is it by coincidence that a swarm of locusts from Egypt have moved across the border into Israel today, just weeks before Mr. Obama's arrival in the Holy Land? Tens of millions of locusts have attacked Egypt in recent days.
A swarm of locusts.
A swarm of locusts. But you see, this guy is called Rick Wiles. He is a so-called radio talk show host.
Well, these guys are so foolish.
But listen, what else?
In recent months, Mr. Obama has been photographed with flies buzzing around his head or attached to his lip or forehead. Each time I see the flies buzzing around him, I think of Beelzebub, Lord of the Flies. Beelzebub claims to cause destruction through tyrants, to cause demons to be worshipped among men, to excite priests to lust, to cause jealousies in cities and murders, and to bring forth war on the world. So think about it. The next time you see a fly land on Barack Obama's lip or forehead, I wouldn't be surprised if Israel is covered with locusts when he arrives in Jerusalem in 3 weeks. How many biblical signs do we need to see to know that this man is evil?
Evil.
Now, did you know that, George, that he was the man of evil?
Of course. Everybody knows that.
It's still voted for.
The Tea Party's been telling us for years he's the evil. He's the personification of evil. They couldn't be wrong. Fox News is telling us that. I can't believe Fox News could be inaccurate or wrong. They're fair and balanced, remember.
But
they erased it and they wrote over it. It wasn't Hawaii. It was hell. That's where he's from.
But this guy Rick Wiles even went further.
What will be the spiritual consequences of the American people allowing Barack Obama to spiritually sodomize the nation? Bishop Harry Jackson Jr. is on the telephone. I'm going to ask him that question. Bishop Jackson, welcome to the program.
Rick, I'm glad to be with you. You have quite a way with words. That was an intense introduction.
Am I being overdramatic in saying that Barack Obama has spiritually sodomized the nation?
Billy!
No. Well, there was. But see, there's one more I got to play for you.
Spiritually
what it means is he's not just a you know, smooth-talking, jive-talking street thug that talked his way into the White House. It means that he was placed here. He was deliberately placed here as a child. He is a manufactured person, and the conclusion I've come to is that he is a foreign plant.
Oh. No. Now.
He's a foreign plant from where? Hell? I mean,
how do we ever expect to give someone $31.50 for food if they're going to support a sodomizing, locust-hailing, lip-flying Beelzebub thug from hell?
Yeah, who's jive talking?
Who's also a jive talker. I mean, Judge, did you notice, and you still voted for this man?
It's, I'm telling you, it's just, it's beyond, it's surreal. I mean, you can't, you know, I'm telling you, people are going to look back and not believe this ever took place. That these, I don't know. I don't know how you run against, you know, the Tea Party and stuff like that, because, you know, you give people credibility when you even discuss their, you know, you're giving them credibility by even discussing what they're saying. Because if somebody, you know, it's just so unbelievable. I mean, you legitimize it by even discussing it because it's so far out. It's so, it's unbelievable. And I mean, it's scary. It's scary.
But what, 25% or more of the Progressive Party thinks this way? Now, and those are the people who are in the House and Senate. We're not talking about it in the country, but House and Senate. What is BG? What are, how are we going to help people? How, what's that mean? Oh, that's all. How are we going to help people and give people the ability to help themselves if 25% of the people that are going to pass these laws think these people are incompetent or others? There is just no way. And South Carolina and Louisiana are among the completely dumbest. And it's because what do they get out of their TV? They get the same Beelzebub, locust, fly, thugging information on every channel. And by these preachers who come to the stations every day and preach about this nonsense. Speaking about family values, Mr. Gaffney, before today, before I mention a name, have you ever heard of Army General Keith Alexander? George?
I've heard of him. Doesn't have something to do with national security?
I'm impressed. That's better than virtually every other citizen we've ever asked. I'm impressed.
Infiltration, sabotage, mayhem for years. Four-star General Keith Alexander has been building a secret army capable of launching devastating cyber attacks. Now it's ready to unleash hell. And inside Fort Meade, Maryland, a top-secret city bustles tens of thousands of people moving through more than 50 buildings in a city that has its own post office, fire department, police force, and zip code. But it is designed, but it was Kaffa. And it's among the forest of trees surrounded by electrified fences, heavily armed guards protected by anti-tank barriers, monitored by sensitive motion detectors, and watched by rotating cameras. And it, to block any telltale electromagnetic signals from escaping from the inner walls of the building, is wrapped in protective copper shielding, and the one-way windows are embedded with a fine copper mesh. This is the NSA.
We've got a secret city.
Yeah, he is in command. This guy, Alexander, is the director of the world's largest intelligence service, the National Security Agency. He's also chief of the Central Security Service and commander of the U.S. Cyber Command, the Navy's 10th Fleet, the 24th Air Force, and the 2nd Army.
So this is a man in the secret city who has his own Navy,
Air Force
and
Army.
Literally. Not just rhetoric.
No.
Not just saying he has an army of workers.
No.
He has a true army.
True army.
True Air Force.
True Air Force.
And a fleet. Plus his own city.
His own city.
And no one knows his place.
And, well, until a couple of weeks ago. He went to a college graduates. He went to like 4 schools and asked only for the computer specialists to come work for the NSA. They have more mathematicians in those buildings than anywhere in the United States.
Yeah, that reminded me of this. I read this paragraph here about what he looks like.
Oh, yeah.
So
read that.
They said, even though he's a 4-star general,
right,
he more closely resembles a head librarian than George Patton. His face is anemic. His lips are a neutral horizontal line. He's bald, halfway back. He has hair the color of strong teeth. Oh, it has a thing. Strong teeth. It turns gray on the sides where it's cut close to his skin. He's more schoolboy than boot camp. And for a time, he wore large, rimless glasses that seemed to swallow his eyes. In some combat types, could even give him a derisive nickname when he said, Alexander the Geek.
Yeah.
So this unassuming little guy, this librarian, this guy, he truly is one of the most powerful men in the world.
Absolutely.
And you're talking about, you know, the joke, Alexander the Geek. Well, the pun is Alexander the Great. That's what they're...
That's...
You know, this is saying, hey, no joke. This guy is... Talk about an emperor. Here is a guy.
And he's got all the clothes he needs.
Yeah. He's got 50 buildings to put it in, too.
Yes,
but you know what, Thomas, you need to... I'm going to tell Mikey will be an example of this, or know about what I'm saying. You should go back to your high school. Because more than likely, the principal of your high school is about, it won't be 30 years old. The principal of Mikey and I went to Wingate High School in Brooklyn. It was 3,000 students. The principal of that school now is 20, well, now he's, I met him 2 years ago, so now he's 29 years old. He was 27 years old when he became the principal. The principal of the school I taught at in Charlotte was 29. He's maybe 31 now. Because what happens is you can't run a school now unless you have a computer guy at the helm. Not because he runs the school, But you got to get somebody who can send these figures off to Washington now that they teach with all these exams and things like that, and you have to know that your school scored 41.9 on the Richter scale and so-and-so, and you have to send that to Washington to get your money and send it to your state capital. So the only way they can get a computer person to come in and work, they can't start them off as teachers. They go to the college, like you just said, with Alexander. They go to the college. They dig up the brightest people they can in computer science. And the only salary they can give them that would make them come to the school system is that of a principal. So you go to your schools now. I'm telling you now, the principal of the school will be some young guy who never taught, or girl. They never taught. They don't have to. Because, first of all, the title principal doesn't fit them anymore, but they haven't changed the titles. And it's the same thing in the Air Force. You can't have a guy teach him how to fly a jet fighter and then keep the airlines from hiring him away unless you pay him as a colonel. Damn, everybody flying is got to be a colonel. That's the only salary that keep them in the Air Force. They got to change these things. They got to come up with thing where call them computer analysts salaries or something, because they're giving them the title principals, and the guy is like being mistaken for a student in the school that he's supposed to be the principal of, because they haven't changed the salary and the pay scale and the titles to fit the salary that's you have to give them. But I'm telling you, you can't. A 27-year-old guy is the principal of a high school in New York City with 3,000 students. That's not possible.
That's true.
You got to give him that money to get him in there. And if he, believe me, you get an old time hardball principal and put him in the office and send him those figures, he wouldn't know what to do with them. That Mrs. Jones' class scored 48.730 on the test, and is that good or bad? I don't know. Maybe that's the greatest. I don't know. But these guys know it means something to them. You got to put them in charge, or else they won't be in the building. If they're not in the building, you can't send your figures upstate, and you can't send them to the to Washington, and your school will be closed because you won't have any funding. So
that's
a change, and that's what this guy is saying. He's not James Bond. He's not going around kicking down doors and shooting Berettas and stuff. He's sitting down at that computer, and it means something to him.
Hang on, what's good? I mean, the NSA, as I said before, is the nation's largest employer of mathematicians. The Department of Defense created this agency in 1952 to intercept, collect, information, communication. In the past decade, the NSA poured hundreds of millions of dollars into offensive cyber R&D and stuff we'll never know. Okay, and then you got see each one of these commands has their own evil in it, but it's different. Either has a different shield on it. One has a star. One has a steel. The stars is right. One has a lightning bolt in it.
I never even heard of this. It's the Central Security Service of the United States.
Yeah.
This lightning bolt. What the heck? What does he do? It's a combat support agency.
Right.
What?
It coordinates with the Navy, National Guard, Marines, Air Force to eavesdrop on foreign signals like tapping into undersea cable or wireless communications. Remember there was something that they said that the Russians had tapped into our underground Atlantic cable? I think they might even made a movie out of that. But that's what these people do. They listen to the listeners.
Here's one of my favorites. And here it is. CAE, Centers for Academic Excellence.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Directly to his point.
Right.
It said, launched in 1998, the NSA initiative sought to increase the number of colleges and students that are competent in, quote, information assurance. And says last year the agency accredited 4 universities to lead the way in training the next generation of cyber operators in, quote, collection, exploitation, and response.
Here's the thing now. This leads us directly to Mr. Snowden, who, in my estimation, needs to be hung by his little short hairs, because this man, who worked for NASA, the NSA, and told people that he did not like what was going on and resigned and went to a private company that was doing the same thing he was doing, and now he ran away with secrets that he got when he was in that position. And you know the reason why? Because, see, under the NSA, they would have took him and put him in Guantanamo Bay. But he was working for a private contractor. You see,
this is what we talked about, the problem with all the fuzz.
This is the problem. Private contractors aren't under the, they're supposed to be under the same obligation as a, if you're working for the U.S. government. I mean, physically, U.S. government, and not a private contractor.
But the difference is, the military side of things, those people are sworn to defend and uphold the Constitution.
That's right.
They're there for the country.
That's right.
Private
industry
is there for profit.
For profit.
Their God is money.
That's right. So they don't care. So he will sell those things to whoever he knows. Now, let me tell you something else.
That's
why.
Because that's where all the money is.
That's right. Well, the other thing is, I was trying to explain this to somebody else before. You had a young lady. I don't know if, George, you heard that young lady came on and tried to said that she knew him when he was overseas somewhere. And anyway, but she said, I had a top secret clearance too, but I was on the legal side. He had a top secret clearance, but he was on the data collection side. And he was very, very upset about what was going on. He didn't think our rights, the people's rights were being violated and whatnot. And he used to talk to me about it. Now, let me tell you something about that. If that's the case, he's going to be dead meat. Because I had a secret clearance. And I was in fire controls, radar, et cetera, on the F-4 Famjet.
Even saying that now, Mike, I have.
Well, it's just too late. Anyway, the person that worked in NAVCOM, who also worked in his black box, was in the cockpit where all my stuff was all in the cockpit. As a matter of fact, ours was all the cockpit. But the NAVCOM, he had a secret clearance too, but neither one of us could talk about what the other one was doing. And we both had secret clearances. The next clearance up is top secret. So this woman even saying that she was talking to him and he would tell her about what was going on, they both need to go to prison.
Yeah.
So what he was, but you see, these commentators who listened and got all the information, they don't know Jack from Pack Secret from Shinola. So they don't know what's in the code, Uniform Code of Military Justice, or what's secret or top secret. They don't know that that person just saying that was violating national security. And it wouldn't be national security if it wasn't supposed to be secret.
Yep.
So them saying that, oh, I know all the people are in the undercover agents in the CIA, if he did that, he wouldn't be around saying it. Because you don't think the CIA agents and undercover hitmen in Hong Kong?
Yes.
So that is complete nonsense. He, as they said before, and Keith Alexander, our NSA head and head spy master, said, you don't know Jack. And it's true. He don't know Jack.
He's just trying to make a name for himself.
Right.
But that's what we get with these independent contractors. And guess what? Expect it more and more and more often.
Oh, yeah.
Because, hey, there's going to be there's different sides to this. One, you give all these information, databases and access to databases and everything else out to all these companies, they're going to start using against each other.
Of course. Because it's about money.
Yeah, because why wouldn't you? If you've got a leg up into something in your industry that you can make money at and you can cut out the competition because you've got secret access to all the consumers or whatever, then you would use it. It's foolish not to. Why would you sit there and just go, oh, I see we're fixing to lose $100 billion this year because we don't act on X, Y, or Z.
Right.
So that's going to happen. That'll be a scandal, when it happens. Secondly, you're going to have disgruntled employees at all of these little companies that go off and run away and tell secrets. But the problem here is that they're not going to run away and say, I know where the broom in the closet of the washroom is. They're going to run away and say, I've got
top secret vital information that the United States gave, and they disclosed it because they've given it to hundreds of thousands of people. You know, they got people with clearances now across the entire freaking United States.
Well, you see, and then we had these newspaper people who say, well, we need to know everything that they know. If they keep it secret, we need to know if it needs to be secret. No, that's not how it works. That's not how it works.
Well, you know how it works? It works like this. And today, we're announcing the existence of and retirement of the SR-71 Black Hawk.
That's right. That's right.
That's how it works.
Right.
30 years ago, this would have been a news story.
That's right. Well, you see, so, I mean, what do you think about that, George, about this guy, Snowden?
Well, the thing I can't get over is when, as you were talking, when you said that this girl said that he used to tell us, I said, well, she should be in jail.
That's
when you said that, I said, she should be in jail. I can't be top secret talking to you and you're top secret and we're talking secrets. We can't. It's not a community. It's not a community group or something. It's not a, you know, match.com dating service. You can't. I mean, when she said she doesn't understand that. I mean, it's like a cop saying, "Well, you know, I was talking to my friend and he told me he killed three people, but you know, he said keep it a secret." And I said, "Okay, I don't understand." I mean, she's not too bright because I don't understand how she could say that they sat around talking about secret stuff. If he's and he could have done all the talking, but she cannot allow him to do the talking.
And she's the lawyer.
She said she's in the legal department.
That's right.
She said she was in the legal department. That makes it worse.
Makes it even worse that she said, "Look, you can't talk to me about this. I'm in the legal department. Let me tell you something." But see, he purposely left there so he could go work for a company that he could talk from.
Right.
Because it's a different thing. Now, what needs to be done? They started doing all this and hiring all these extra private companies after 2001, after the World Trade Center. The problem is, just like when they tried to, that James Comey, our nominee for Attorney General, stopped them for going and violating our rights. These people don't care about the rights. As Thomas says, it's about the buck. And when you have thousands, they went to thousands and thousands of people in the private industry because they don't want to pay government salaries. They said, no, we will go to private industry, we give them X amount of money, and if they want to pay insurance, let them pay insurance. We don't have to worry about overtime. We don't have to worry about retirement. We don't have to worry about nothing. Person gets killed, dies, fine. Boom, boom. We get somebody. They get somebody else. We don't have to get nothing. So this is all about, since Reagan fired the controllers, it's about contracting everything out. And I want to tell you something. I got my car washed today before we run the air. And there used to be four guys, where you come in, and because they have two entrances, and right next to one another, you can see each car, and two guys in each entrance, and one would vacuum on one side, another one would vacuum on the other side, and then the other car, they had two people doing the same thing. They got one guy doing it now. One guy doing it now. And I gave him a tip, and he said, you know, thank you for thinking about me. They never think about that I don't do any work here. You know, I'm doing all these cars now. And when I saw the cars pull around where they're supposed to get soaked and, just started before it goes into the wash, they used to have two guys over there that would throw some soap on the wheels, buff up the wheels so when it went through the wash, all the crud would come off and everything. They have automatic scrubbers now. You don't have to do that with the car anymore. So they got rid of the two people that were that part of it through automation.
Yeah.
So those two people don't have a job anymore.
Yeah,
so now they got rid of six people. Six people now. They got rid of before the car even gets into the wash.
Yeah.
And now they got rid of another person on the outside, so the guy that takes your money on the inside, he has to come out and help them polish the car.
But here's the deal.
It's all about not paying. Bottom line.
Yeah, it's just
we profits. Need to keep the money for ourselves.
Profits, you know?
And this goes back to the farm bill. And this guy Fincher, where he said, I want to cut the daggone $31.50 by 12% so I can get more money in my pocket out of the money I take from the poor person.
Right.
Same thing.
This back then, you know, Cheney was one of the champions of privatization. He has been since the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
He's one who wrote a paper back in the 70s said we need to privatize the entire Pentagon.
Why did you privatize the Congress?
Every bit of it. They were talking about in the wars, for instance, that we've just been fighting, you know, these longest wars in American history we've just been going through. They said that all we did, because they privatized the war on terror, it's been bleeding our economy dry because it was a source of endless profit, right? Because they could just constantly outsource
mm-hmm.
everything. And,
right.
of course, they outsourced it to themselves and their
right.
companies, because you know how they did that with, you know, Halliburton.
Right.
Well, for instance, this just in Iraq and Afghanistan, the war effort there alone is costing us now $4.4 trillion. Is what it's going to take. Okay. $31 billion of it has already been accounted for as total waste and fraud, and they think it's as high as $60 billion that they just stole because contractors have such differing systems and math, you know, all this fuzzy math,
mm-hmm.
you know, accounting that they do, that they've lost that much that they've never been able to recover just because they're using all these thousands of different companies instead of going through the military like they should.
Right.
Then it says, now they've taken over everything from janitorial and food services to the heavy construction, security, intelligence. Everything has now been privatized.
Mm-hmm.
So the government, the military doesn't do it anymore. It's all handled by independent companies, which means that it's also they don't communicate well with each other, da, 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 da. And we've ended up becoming more disorganized, right? And then
duplication.
So just to point out how much money we're wasting, $12 million per day for Afghanistan, United States. Put another way, they said that means the government is spending more on the war in Afghanistan than all 50 states combined, combining health, education, welfare, and safety. They're spending on that privatization of the war in Afghanistan. So that gives you an example of how much you're talking about an endless gold mine that these private companies have discovered. And that's why they're doing it. Because why do something through the military where you make the soldiers go out there and, you know, fix the plumbing and you can pay some guy $200, you know, to go and put in the gold pipe that doesn't fit the silver, you know. So,
and you shot and die and just kick them to the curb.
Yeah, and you don't have to pay for any.
No, pay for anything. Right. Right now we have someone on the line here.
Just moved the headquarters to Dubai.
Right. Hello, who's this?
Michael, this Hello? Is Randy Bowler, chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party. How are you doing?
I am doing fine, Randy. How are you? Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, too. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, okay. Well, hey, I am working up a good sweat here now. We were just talking about
the privatization
and the retirement of state, federal, and city workers, but not retiring them, just but keeping them because you can't fire them, but hiring private contractors to do their job. And losing money because the private contractor, of course, we don't have to pay them vacation. We don't have to pay them any pensions. We don't have to pay anything. It's just like when I was with the weather service and they wanted to contract the weather forecasters out. They couldn't find the weather forecasters. They brought in somebody to run the station. But they still had to have the forecasters because the people that ran the station weren't forecasters.
Right.
So, you know, privatization is killing us.
Yeah, you probably hired the senior.
And there's no senior. Yeah, and so what do you see so far? And I know there's a multiplicity of things you're seeing what this regressive government is doing there under Mr. Duke Powers' leadership in Raleigh. But what do you see that they are trying to do to the state workers that are working up there in Raleigh, the legislature?
Well, first off, to address your issue on privatization and what your other guest was saying, I mean, I've always viewed that as being an outsourcing of the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're essentially taking the social contract that we all bought into, that great leaders in the state had built, going back to Terry Sanford and Carr Scott, Frank Quartergraham, Jim Hine, others, and they're breaking the social contract. I mean, what made the state great and what gave us the foundation. As far as what's going on in Raleigh, you know, Republicans have a very interesting habit of whether they win by one vote or 1,000, they say they have a mandate. And they are running a legislative program that they've wanted to run, that Alec is essentially giving them the blueprint, as you know, and it's being funded by Art Pope and the Koch brothers and a host of other people that want these programs. And, yes, I mean, one of the fascinating aspects about the outsourcing that you were referring to previously is that my father was in the military, and when you start creating the private contractors, they're getting paid 3 and 4 times what the ordinary soldier was getting paid. And
right.
So you have less of them, and your actual payroll skyrockets, and it's their incentive to hold on to these contracts. And, of course, at that level, it gets you around the Geneva Convention. But in this state, you know, what it's doing, it's essentially allowing them to take what we were building in this state and actually shifting the wealth. And that's really what's going on.
Well,
I
don't understand this. How legal, I mean, maybe it wasn't illegal, but how could they justify hiring Art Pope?
Hiring Art Pope?
Yes.
That's a very good question. I guess from a political perspective, you know, he would probably say, you know, that he's the godfather, so to speak, and he's going, you know, that he deserves to have his position. But, you know, it does kind of create a strange situation that a person that has funded so much of this radical extreme legislature would then have his hands on the checkbook of North Carolina. You know, I think that's kind of the fox guarding the chicken coop.
Well, yeah, I mean, but isn't it that you, as you said, the fox guarding the chicken coop? It's just like what I was talking about this guy Fincher in the House, and where he had his assistant go on the saying that he could live on $31.50 a week. That the SNAP program people live on, and he came back and said, I lived on $27.58, and we need to cut it by another 12%. But yet that 12% that they're going to cut, they wanted to cut the SNAP program with, would have went in Fincher's pocket, because he's one of the 15 members of the House, and that got over $237,000 plus from taxpayer subsidies for a farm subsidy program last year. I mean, this is the same thing that they're going to cut out they're cutting out the SNAP program. They want to cut down. What are the things that they want to cut here in the state? They want to cut the unemployment, right? The unemployment issue.
Well, they're cutting everything back, but what they fail to understand is when you cut the program back, you cut out the ability for people to spend money in their communities, and the economy contracts. I mean, they're creating a higher level of misery. I mean, you can't have a growing and thriving economy if people can't pay for their rent, if people can't buy their necessities. I don't really know if they understand the kind of Dickensian society they're going to create. I mean, it's going to look more like the 19th century than the 21st century.
Oh, yeah, but see, you think they don't know. I think they do know, and they don't want those people here. They don't want the unions here. They want to be able to have you work for 5 cents an hour or just got away, and they want this lower wage person in the state that will love their job and not fight them ever because they would be afraid to lose it.
Well, it's pretty simple, Michael, from an economics perspective, why they want to do that. If you can put keep wages low, okay, then you can actually hold inflationary pressures low, and then you can ensure that people that hold long-term bonds, that they don't have issues with your yields. When inflation goes up, bonds become devalued. So people that are holding long-term bonds don't want that. The clearest way to do it is to depress wages. What you need to ask, as a radio show host and as someone that's interested in these topics, ask these Republicans, what does the world look like? You know, I believe in a utopia, in a utopian vision where we can build better communities. They believe in dystopia, something that's kind of disgusting and ugly, all right? Make them paint the picture. Tell them say, what is it going to look like when everyone's, as you just said, is getting paid a low wage? How can you raise a family? How can you live the American dream?
The problem is they don't care about your family. They don't care about theirs. So the thing is that making 5 cents, that's your problem. I mean, if you're only making 5 cents, that's your problem.
That's why in their world, the masses are like, you know, the freaking zombie horde of the apocalypse out there, and they live in their gated communities with their little McMansions.
Right.
You know, fending off the poor.
And, you know, and the thing is that here in North Carolina, so people did not come out and vote in 2010. Now we're stuck with these moronic hybrids for 10 years. So what it's going to take is for those Democrats that I'm concerned about who did not vote in 2010, and those Republicans who think that who they voted for was their way to go, they are going to be thrown under the bus also. So they need to realize, and we don't know how long it's going to take them to realize. It might take them 5 years to realize or 6 years to realize that what they did was self-defeating. But meantime, everybody's going to suffer. Now, as chair of the Democratic Party, for the whole state, chair of the Democratic Party, how are you gathering your forces to make sure that those people who did not vote Democrats, and while you're at it, you can throw a little bit to those Republicans that did not vote, say, hey, you were fooled, you're going to pay sooner or later. May not be now, but it will be soon, and it might be for the rest of your life, but you need to get across to them how important it is to them that they need to come out and get into their community school boards and county commissions and county city councils, because that's where it's going to start for us to rebuild this.
Yeah, it needs to restart at the local and county level. I agree with you. Getting people to run and get involved in your local elections and put out our values, you know, what we believe in, which you're talking about on the show. But, yes, there was a drop-off in 2010, specifically in the African-American community, but across all communities in vote. And my job and what we're working on is building these county party organizations to be vibrant and robust and strong enough to get out that base vote and then message out to unaffiliates and others that are going to vote our way. I mean, we are gerrymandered into a tricky situation, but I firmly believe we can make gains over the next three cycles. Specifically, we could get a big wave election in 2016, and don't underestimate 2014. The Republican legislature right now is at a historically low popularity. And the Moral Monday movement is shining a light, which the Democratic Party is supporting, on these issues. We need to translate that energy into every community and turn that into electoral victories. And that's where you can help us by reminding people that, look, your vote does count.
Well, you know,
a difference when you go to the ballot box.
I was talking before you came on. I don't know if you heard that, but I got my car washed today. And there's a guy there who I know, and they went automated. And six people were laid off. He's now the only one that cleans and vacuums your car when you come in. There used to be four people because there was two entrances. And we got to talking because when he drove the car around before he got into the wash, there used to be two people out there with the hoses where they throw the soap on the car and they do your wheels and everything. He don't do that anymore. That's not done anymore because he goes over there, makes sure the car's incorrectly, and when it gets pulled in, they now have an automated machine that cleans the smoke and puts on the heavy wax and everything. So I said, my God, so you're going to be doing it now? I said, yes. He says, you know, let me ask you a question, because I had my Obama T-shirt on. He said, I want to ask you, this guy is white, and he said, let me ask you a question. You know, I never voted, so I don't know. I said, what do you mean you never voted?
He's an adult.
Oh, yes, guy's adult. He's in his 50s. And I said, what do you mean you never voted? Well, maybe he's in his 40s. So he said, I said, what do you mean you never voted? He said, well, I'm a felon. I said, so? He said, well, you mean I can vote? I said, heck yes. Have you finished all your service time? He said, yes, everything. I said, well, why? He said, well, everybody I spoke to told me that I will never be able to vote because I was a felon. I said, these people didn't want you to vote. I said, I'm going to bring you, the next time I come, into this car wash, a registration form.
Uh-huh.
You can vote. And you just tell anybody else that you know that if they need a registration form, you know where to get one for them. Because there are people out there that are telling you that I asked a half a dozen or more people when election time came around, I wish I could vote. And he said, oh, and I told him I had a felony. He told him, no, you can't vote. You never be able to vote again. So you see, what's being told in the communities?
They don't want
people to vote.
They're getting misled. I mean, if they've paid their time for their crime, they can vote. But it's been a common Republican practice to put out misinformation. So the fact you're educating that gentleman is doing a service, Michael.
And let me just let you listen to this.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Now, that was said by Paul Reinrich, the father of the Conservative Party.
Of Alex, yes. Can you send me that clip, Michael?
Sure, I can send you that clip, sure.
Send me that clip, because I like that clip. I've seen that on a documentary before, and I've heard it on your show a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically what they believe.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing. This is their founding principles in their own mouth. You know, it's not like maybe they think that. No, this is what they directly state.
I mean, so the thing is, the less, you know, it's like there was a old saying I always used to say from Star Trek. He said, there's a need, as Spock used to say, there's a need of the many, I would have needed a few. There's a need of the few, I would have needed the many. You know, so right. It's the need of the few outweighing the need of the many. So, you know, that's a Randy. Did you hear that?
I heard that.
Yeah. So, where are we in gathering these 13 congressional districts and these 100 counties together? in North Carolina?
Well, you mean in terms of organizing?
Yes, yes, including organizing, right.
We're in the process now of putting together what I think is going to be a good organizational plan. I mean, look, in Chatham County, we led the state voter turnout in 08 and 2012, and I've been working at this grassroots politics and getting the vote out for quite a while. There's a lot of things we can do that aren't just technological. They're just basically rolling up your sleeves and doing the basics.
Right.
You know, you saw the finals last night, so, you know, I was a Michael Jordan fan, you know, because I was grew up in Chicago, and LeBron James won the title. Well, LeBron James has good fundamentals. And, you know, you can't be a superstar as a party if you don't do the fundamentals.
Right.
So
absolutely correct.
Part of it is showing up, handing out ballots at polls, calling your neighbors. Whenever you have a friend or a family member that says something that you know is wrong, you politely remind them that, hey, you might have heard that on Rush Limbaugh, but guess what? That's not factual. we're too polite sometimes.
Yes.
We're in an era that we cannot afford the luxury of just being polite. We have to actually, with respect and strength, confront these lies and come right out and say, excuse me, but that's wrong, and let's just talk about our values and why, as a society, we need to go this direction because it benefits everyone. That's the funny thing about the Democratic Party. Our values actually help everybody. Whether you're Republican or Democrat or an affiliate, you do well if you do these things. If you invest in a demand-driven economy, everyone does well.
Well, right now we got joining us a friend of yours, Randy.
Yes.
I tell you what. Yeah, well, he's going to let you know in just a minute.
Dr. Galloway, how are you?
Hi, Michael. I'm fine. I am fine.
Good. And how's the baby? And how's Joe?
The baby is good. He's visiting his girlfriend, you know.
Oh, God.
I hope not,
because, you know, the Republican legislature might not let that happen.
That's right.
Yeah. Joe's still in the hospital. He's going to be out tomorrow, we hope. We hope tomorrow.
Good.
Yeah, I know. He was supposed to leave today, but spiked a little temperature, so had to keep him another day.
Okay.
Let me talk about what Randy just said about us speaking up, about us not being so polite. He's got such a good point there, because I've got to tell you, I was standing in line to get coffee, and this elderly lady comes up and says, to the guy who's making the coffee, hey, what do you think about Obama and the IRS? And this guy says, Obama and the $70 million that he's giving to the IRS. And this guy says he goes off. He's furious. Now, how could Obama give all this money to the IRS? But actually, that's not the case. Obama says, no, you cannot get it. But they listen to Bo News. And, you know, Fox News has never let truth stand in their way. So they managed to spin the whole thing so that it's now standing on its head and people believe it. Randy's correct. We have to be polite enough to say, but forceful enough to say, actually, that's not right. Actually, not so much. Yeah.
Because
we've not done that.
Well, as you said, we have to speak up, and it shows you why you have to speak up. Just look at this.
Hi, I'm Ted Cruz, and this is the Freedom Minute. The IRS scandal revealed the targeting of conservative groups, Tea Party groups, pro-life groups, and pro-Israel groups for intrusive questions and harassing. This is the consequence of an agency that is too big and has too much power. And now the IRS is supposed to be put in charge of administering Obamacare. Enough is enough. We need to abolish the IRS, eliminate the intrusive agents, and replace the IRS and the tax code with a simple flat tax where every American can file his or her taxes on a postcard.
Now, how many things, when you make a 41-second statement, how many things can you say that are absolutely positively wrong? You said half a dozen. I mean, the IRS doesn't administer Obamacare. And if you get rid of the IRS and you want to send your postcard in, who are you sending it in to? If there's no IRS. There's no tax collection. I mean,
you know, Ted Cruz's IQ is about 2 points higher than that of a rock. Just thought you ought to know that. And that's the reason this garbage gets spewed out of his mouth. The man, how he got elected, of course he got elected in Texas. Not sad, right?
Well, that, and that's
sadly,
that.
Hey, sadly, he's a member of all of that. You've been like Governor Parrish.
Harvard graduate?
Yeah.
Joe is a Harvard graduate. Dang, really?
He's a Harvard graduate lawyer.
Oh, my God.
Mm. But hey, we got George Bush is a graduate of Yale.
Yeah.
He failed Texas University because he was too tough. So George got into Yale because of his father. Because he was too rich.
Evidently, Ted Cruz is pretty smart. He just says stupid things, but he says stupid things for a purpose, and that is to he's pandering to his base, and his base happens to be the underinformed group of people.
Now, how health care going to be administered here in North Carolina? It's not, right? Because the government's not taking it, right?
Yeah.
Randy?
You're grateful.
I was going to say something about that statement you had played there. I mean, it's been a strong libertarian and Republican idea for a long time. With Steve Forbes ran on it and before for using various forms of flat taxation. It's simple and it sounds elegant in an argument. Except the problem is that if you're worth $100 million and you're paying 10%, you still have $90 million left. If you're somebody, that is already struggling, you're taking away actually people's ability to buy groceries. And then they throw out different versions of this. It's meant to appeal as a red meat issue. I mean, let's face it. If the Republican Party had embraced what was good for America, we would have had the public option, and we wouldn't be dealing with this foolishness about who's going to be administering Obamacare. This was a program that people did to try to work together with Republicans. This was a program that Romney put in, a program that Bob Dole and those liked in 92 and 96, and then when we actually compromised with them, we were attacked viscerally. So if we got the program that John Conyers wanted and others, we'd have had single payer.
That's right.
Simple as that. So I resent the fact that they criticize us for actually trying to be bipartisan.
And
throw out these ideas about the IRS. Look, nobody loves the IRS because nobody likes to be investigated. But to throw out, I'm going to pay my taxes on the back of a postage card, it's just a kind of ridiculous, simplistic logic that gets you into these problems to begin with. The same logic that said, I'm going to go invade Iraq because the war will pay for itself. Well, I challenge Wolfowitz and everyone else that signed Project for New American Century to come back and pay that bill because we're in the trillions on paying for that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I resent it when they do that kind of stuff and try to appeal to the red meat base for the same reason your other callers in would resent it because it's simplistic thinking that misleads Americans.
Well, the thing is that they don't really want it either because that means the people who don't pay any taxes right now would start paying taxes. So why would they do that? That makes no common sense whatsoever. So it's nothing but a throw line
to get people riled up.
Right.
Because they don't want to pay taxes. And right now, as we said, the last 2 years or 10 years, GE paid no taxes.
I mean, that's the whole deal. Ever since the Reagan years, we've been hacking the corporate tax rate down to nothing.
Right.
You know, they used to pay six times, you know, what any citizen pays. Now they pay cents on the dollar to what citizens pay in taxes, which is exactly why every year we have shortfalls and they keep having to do things like raise taxes.
That's right.
Property taxes.
That's right.
Taxes.
And when they say poor people don't pay taxes, that's an outright lie. You pay taxes every time you go to a grocery store.
Right.
You buy a can of soda with that SNAP program, $31.50, you're paying taxes on that soda.
Well, with anything.
You don't say it's federal income taxes, but they pay city, state, car taxes, road taxes. I mean, you know, but why don't you have people say that to them when they're being questioned? They pay all these other taxes. You never hear that. It's always after the fact. Grace, to Louisiana. Because you still didn't need this for a while. But I saw something last night. And 60% of the people who live in Louisiana do not have health insurance and have no prospects of even getting health insurance.
I'm not.
Because there's no way to get health insurance.
Moron. I never mentioned.
Hey, do you hear me?
Yes.
You're breaking up. Go ahead. I can hear you now, but you were breaking up a little bit, Michael.
I'm probably going to, we're driving down 421. I'm going to probably lose you up here.
Okay.
All right.
I just want to say thank you very much. I'm willing to call in on any Friday and talk to you guys and listen and keep up the good work.
All right. Did you have any message?
You do the same.
Yes.
Any message would you like to leave for the Democratic listeners in North Carolina?
I just want them to know that we're out here traveling the state. We're gonna visit any and all counties. I've been around the state today. And the focus for our attention should be the extreme Republican legislature that's been operating, and we need to be organizing every day because they've been showing us exactly what happens when we don't go out to work.
Right. Okay. That's Randy.
Thank you very much, Michael. You're a gentleman.
The chair of North Carolina Democratic Party, and he will be back with us again.
I love
Okay. Grace?
Mm-hmm.
Grace?
I'm here. Michael.
So, I was listening last night when they were interviewing and I can't remember her name. She's the head of the free clinics in the country.
Nicole Lamoureux.
Yeah. And for when it got to the point, the commenter couldn't believe that 20% of all people in Louisiana do not have even a chance to get health insurance if
that's
they
correct.
Want it.
That is correct.
And the ACH, Obamacare, since 2012 has saved over $4 billion across the country in Medicare costs. And the premiums in the state exchanges have fallen below, in 9 states, way below what they even dreamed the estimates would be. And that has also started to decrease the cost of health insurance across the country, and that's stated by Pricewaterhouse. I said this before, but by October, 30 million more people will be eligible for health care in the United States. 30 million more.
Right, and it certainly could be higher than that. Now, remember, eligible doesn't mean they're going to get it. All right,
that's
because
correct.
With 46 to almost 47 million people that are uninsured at this point in time, now 30 million are eligible, but not all of them are going to get it. And why is this? It's because states like North Carolina and South Carolina and Louisiana have rejected, okay, rejected Medicare, expansion of Medicare within their states. So let's just talk about North Carolina and talk about that rejection of Medicaid, within this state. This means that 500,000 people in the state of North Carolina will either be dropped off the rolls or that would ordinarily be eligible, okay, that ordinarily would be eligible for Medicaid would suddenly become ineligible or dropped off the rolls.
Right. When you say dropped off the rolls, what do you mean? Explain that a little bit.
It means they get a letter and say, sorry, you're no longer qualified.
For what reason?
And generally the reason is there's not enough money. Okay? The claim is there's not enough money. Or they're Medicaid, and so they change the qualifications. Or their Medicaid is reduced by a certain amount. So while they may have Medicaid, their benefits under Medicaid are reduced or their copay may increase, so it's not supposed to increase. You're not supposed to stay at $3, right? It may increase. That we at this point in time, it's sort of like a crapshoot. We don't know. We don't know exactly how this is going to impact the people that are currently covered, but we do know that the people that are not covered that would have qualified will not be able to qualify because Governor McCrory, Mayor Pat, decided that if he was going to reject the financing, the $15.5 billion from the federal government to help expand Medicaid within North Carolina with the claim that it was too expensive.
What is the reason why any governor would reject free money for 3 years?
Because he was able to do, remember I said a little earlier about taking the truth and spinning it around so that it's standing on its head? And that's what they did with this one. This is exactly what they did with this one. They actually got people to believe that it would cost the state more money if they accepted the $15.5 billion from the federal government. That it would cost more money and then therefore it would cost us more, North Carolinians more informed in the form of taxes, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So, again, they lied. It's bottom line, they lied. Lied.
I can understand when people lie, you know, and there's always, just like Goebbels during the Nazis, during World War II, there's always a thread of truth in it to get you to believe it. Okay, what is the thread of truth that they are weaving through this gobbledygook that will let me believe that they're telling the truth that it's going to cost us more? Well, what can they say? That, I mean, if you're the average, not talking about mathematicians, scientists, how could they say this to people and people would believe them?
Well, they first talk about the deficit. They first talk about how much money North Carolina owes the federal government in unemployment. And North Carolina does owe the federal government, you know, some money. It does. But it's not required to pay it all back in a lump sum. That's not required. The federal government has never asked North Carolina to pay or any state to just dig into your pocket and, you know, we want it back now. You know, they've never asked that. But the way the Republicans have twisted it is that they're saying, well, we owe the federal government and we are living in deficit. And they keep focusing on that deficit thing. And they keep focusing on this thing about, you know, if the family's income is reduced, then what the family does is it tightens their belt. And so we have to function just like a family. And I agree, we should tighten our belt. But here's the difference. Here's the false equivalency that they put out, all right? The false equivalency is this. If indeed we're going to function, look, Michael, in your family, okay, if you suddenly had to tighten your belt because you didn't have enough money, you could do that. You would tighten your belt. But would you say to your grandma or your wife, sorry, you don't get to eat because I'm tightening my belt? You wouldn't say that. So that's what these Republicans in Raleigh are saying. They're going to cut benefits for the poor people. They cut, you know, all the social safety networks for the poor people just so that the rich people can continue in the lifestyle in which they are used to. So what they're saying is, Grandma, you don't get to eat. Okay? Sorry. Or, you know, the kid doesn't get to, you get breakfast today. Little Johnny, you get breakfast today, and little Mary, you get breakfast tomorrow. But then you're not getting the, you know, you both can't have breakfast every day.
How do they explain that in the last 3 years, I believe it is, we've cut over $2 billion from the deficit?
They don't. They've ignored that completely. Now, let's add in this other thing also into the mix. Aside from, you know, saying, Grandma, you don't get to eat because we don't have enough money, they're also telling Grandma, oh, by the way, we're going to tax your Social Security income. So, Grandma, you get to eat even less.
Yeah.
So it makes it even more difficult for you. So what they've done is, again, they've just, I think this is evil incarnate myself. This is absolutely evil stuff. So what they've done is they've absolutely ignored the facts. And the facts are that, yes, indeed, the deficit has been reduced. Yes, but they ignore it. All they talk about is the same old garbage, which are lies, by the way. And they keep saying, we have X trillion dollars in deficit. Well, we may have, but it's being cut. But they don't talk about that. They don't talk about the fact that the programs that President Obama has put into place have actually reduced the deficit. What might heaven help them? They can't say something that this smart black man did, you know?
Yeah.
They can't possibly.
Right.
Because that would just be, their heads would explode.
Right. So, you know, you said, I mean, some 10 years ago, nobody cares about the system. That doesn't mean nothing. I mean,
that's because they were busy creating.
Right. Well, we see, but the thing is that, and I don't agree with states tightening their belts. That creates a place like they have over in Europe.
Yeah.
You don't decrease, cut back when you're losing.
And they're having a hard time coming out of recession. And if we just remember this little formula, for every $1 that is spent, it goes around seven times, so it actually regenerates seven times. So if
right.
I buy something from you for $1, you're not going to just take that $1 and put it in a savings account. You're going to spend that $1, correct? And the next person
right.
is going to take that $1 and spend it also. So it actually circulates
right.
seven times, and that is how the economy is stimulated. And it's a very simple – by the way, even the Heritage Foundation admits to that one. Hello?
Oh.
You know?
So – the thing is that when it was so funny. I was telling my grandkids, picked them up from summer camp the other day, and my wife and I, because I wasn't driving yet, but they said to my wife, Grandma, I want some chicken McNuggets. So my wife says, I don't have any money with me. I can't do that. She says, well, yes, you do. Ask Grandpa for it. I don't have any money. Why are you driving if you have no money? That's what Blake said. Why are you driving if you have no money? So we got no money for a chicken McNuggets because we cooked dinner at the house. So, I want chicken McNuggets. I said, well, then you'll eat nothing. Well, I said, God. And we'll give him chicken McNuggets. So you see, that's why they asked, what could you give in? So the thing is that there are certain things like the country. They keep saying, well, you know, you wouldn't have those deficits. And everybody's got deficits. When you buy a house, you don't pay $100,000 or $200,000 cash. You're in a deficit. We operate a whole deficit. What are these people talking about? How are they talking about?
Well,
if you're not in deficit, you're dead.
there was no deficit, it wouldn't be.
But I will.
That's right. If there were no deficits, there'd be no banking industry.
Yeah, I mean, if everything goes around, it's just like
Right.
You know, the way they kill you, the circular system, is to take everybody's money.
That's right.
And then chop it down and take it and go, ha, 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 ha.
Well,
and wait until the whole thing collapses around you like a house fire.
And I remember the one thing that's always sticks in my mind where Henry Ford said, I'm building these cars, but I got to build them for the people who are working here can buy them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, they're only the super rich could afford
Right.
And they went nowhere.
Right. And so, hey, if I can get the employees to buy the car, they can come to work quicker, I can get more things done, they can stay longer, work later, but if I price them out of their range, what good is that?
Well, you know, I had this conversation with my grandfather once, a wise man, and I was, you know, a young guy, but I was lamenting. I saw something on the news about some, you know, great inventor, and I said, boy, I wish I was a genius and I could think up this, you know, million-dollar idea, just have something in return. Never have to work again and live in my castle and, you know, take care of you and all and everybody else. And my grandfather was like, well, son, that's a lofty ideal, you know. He said, but big, gigantic inventions can change the world. And he said, few and far between. He said, you know, only one time does someone, like, harness fire or invent writing or whatever, you know. He said, but for the rest of it, I said, why don't you just be the guy? Maybe you didn't invent writing or writing utensil, but you picked up an eraser and stuck it on the end of the pencil.
Right.
You know? He said, because I'm pretty sure if you could sell a million erasers for a cent a piece to people on that, you could retire as wealthy. Said, it doesn't take one thing, you know.
Exactly.
You just do a whole bunch of little things. And I was like, oh, good enough.
So, what do we think about these free clinics around the country have added so much to the healthcare system, it is unbelievable. People just don't know how much they've helped people. I mean, it's really...
Go ahead.
It's part of the American way now.
Yeah, our free clinic, Gavaris County, our patient population base has exploded, literally exploded. We're seeing so many, the numbers are just phenomenal now, and it's sad because it's only going to go up, especially with the denial of expansion of Medicaid into North Carolina. It's only going to go up with all of the different programs that these Republicans in Raleigh have implemented. All they're doing is setting us back, North Carolina back about, you know, 250 years. As far as education and food, I mean, they're cutting food stamps. How can you cut food stamps on people? Do they even begin to realize that so many military families are dependent upon food stamps? Do they not understand that? Yeah,
military families are on food stamps and on the SNAP program. So they are going to cut back. That Steve Fincher needs to be hung by his short hair.
I know. And then I hear people saying, well, it is not the job of the government or the school to feed the family. It is the job of the parent. Well, you know what? If they don't have the money to feed them, what do we say? Sorry, you don't get to eat again because your mama should feed you or your daddy should feed you? Well, you know, what the heck is this all about? What?
Hey,
it's unbelievable.
Can't afford to pay their child? They probably can't afford to bury it either.
That's right. That's right. What are we going back to? The Charles Dickens era, you know, of Oliver Twist?
Right.
Oh, what are we going to do? Open workhouses and poorhouses again? Are we going to have debtors' prisons? What is this? You know, are we going back to the Dickensian era?
Well, we are, but, you know, this era will be totally different because they'll privatize those debtors' prisons and make them a huge profit off of it.
Oh, I'm sure they will. They already are. They are already privatizing prisons, and you're absolutely right. They'll the first debtor's prison that is open, well, that's what they'll put them. You know? That is it's just shocking to me.
Governor McCrory, wasn't he just a month or two ago, he was talking about privatizing all the Medicaid. You know, he wanted to get rid of that share. They're cutting got a news item right here, North Carolina, they're cutting the tax holiday. And the tax holiday was only for, you know, poor people trying to send their children to school.
Oh, yeah.
And so now they're not even going to give the people, it's like, they hate taxes now anyway, but yet they're going to cut that out because that only helps poor people.
Yeah, we saw the thing in the news we just talked about before the show started about if you bought a hybrid car, they now want to charge $50 more because you're not buying a S.
Yeah.
I mean, are we saying, is this becoming, is this,
it's just, look,
it's Kafka.
It's just more, punishment for anything that isn't their industry or their profit circle. So if you're going to drive an electric car, you know, they're going to nail you for $100. If you're going to drive a hybrid car, they're going to nail you for $50 and laugh about it because they want you to drive the biggest gas-guzzling SUV humanly possible.
I mean, it's just incredible. What is going to be what Governor Duke Power does? How does that affect the free clinics? Does it affect the free clinics anyway?
Well, here's the thing. Okay, actually, there is a bill up. There is a bill up before the House right now that would provide some money. It's a fund that helps provide for drugs for the poor people. Okay, and we free clinics do get a small amount of money, not a whole lot of money, but it's enough to keep. Remember, for every $1 that we receive, we provide at least $7 worth of goods and services. All right. So there is right now before in Raleigh a bill that has come up before the House, the House budget includes this funding for free clinics for medication. It is not in the Senate budget. So there's got to be a reconciliation between the House budget and the Senate budget. And what we're doing right now is we're lobbying the Senate very, very hard to say, look, you've got to accept this part of the House budget. Please accept it, because if nothing else, your constituents are going to suffer. Now, I don't know if they're still debating it, and I don't know how the pieces are going to fall. But we've got this. Here's one other thing. Let's cut this particular piece of funding. We'll stop grandma and grandpa from getting their medicines. What the heck? You know, as long as our rich people can get their medicines, we don't care about grandma and grandpa who happen to be poor and living in a trailer. So what?
Right.
Again,
right.
It's the same thing, the family situation, all right? We don't have enough money, so grandma, sorry, you can't have your medicines this month. You know, not only can you not eat, this month you can't eat. Next month you can eat, but next month you don't get your medicine.
Right.
This is basically what they're saying.
Thomas just had something for Duke Power. What are they going to do?
It's just the endless rain of bad news. But
Duke Energy, I'm sorry.
He was
Uncle Duke
making a joke about, you know, having Duke sit in the governor's mansion, but that's exactly what we've got now. And so, surprise, surprise, as soon as he's in, there's suddenly a 5% rate hike from Duke Energy for all Carolina customers. You know, so again, this is going to be a hardship on people who already are struggling to pay their bills.
If this man wins a second term, it would be a shame on us. Shame on us. Really.
Absolute disaster.
Well, they could win because our Pope will probably control the voting machine.
They control the voting machines, and they rigged all the, you know, districts.
And I asked Randy that, how in the Lord's name are they able to put someone like
Pope in handling the money in this state? How is that even possible?
Yeah, well, McCrory has clearly no scruples.
Oh, God. Clearly. I mean, you know, he's almost like, well, he was almost like Jekyll and Hyde. Because when he was here, he wouldn't even thought of things like this. But I guess he's punishing us for him running twice before and not winning. So, but he's punishing everybody now. And
yeah.
Even George Bush didn't want him in Washington.
Yeah, there you go.
George Bush
doesn't that tell you something?
So what does that tell you about it?
Exactly.
I mean, unbelievable. Well, we only got a couple of minutes, and I want to say for you to kiss Joe and the baby. And let's see. I hope, we don't have to give the baby talking to Phil Gingrich, because, you know, we have CEO. Make sure I have a good talk. The baby, yeah?
Thank you, Michael. I will convey your regards to Joe.
Okay.
All right. All right.
Thank you. Talk to you next week. Bye.
Okay. Bye bye.
And that was. All right.
One of the best things I heard now, I mean, Dr. Grace is always fun, but from Randy, I love the quote, they are outsourcing the American dream. That's exactly what they're doing.
Absolutely.
You know, because you think it's just, hey, short-term profits, we're just doing this and doing that and making some money because whatever, but you are. You're selling those people's jobs away. You're taking their dreams away because every time you have another contractor, you know, build a shower at a camp instead of the guy who was originally hired to do it, then that guy's lost his job.
That's right. Well, it's about that time. And I feel good, much better than I have in the last 3 weeks. I want to tell you that. And got a couple of meetings to go to. And maybe see Superman on Sunday. And I want everybody to think about James Gandolfini. Tony, may he rest in peace. And about that $50,000 worth of Cougar Ranch and the 45 automatic that Meadow found.
Ed, just to show you, next time you see that neighbor going down to pick up the newspaper in the cul-de-sac, don't insult.
That's right.
I don't know what the man really does.
That's right. Okay, people.
Love
this is what, this was
like
the last word. And I will be seeing you. Have a good weekend. The last word, Michael Lawson and Thomas Waterbury. Good night. Thank you.
Yeah.